know it's something that I tried my best, but I think today we have a very long program, and we must make sure that we finish this program the latest by 3 o'clock. As I promised yesterday, that today we are going to hold a proper workshop. We are not going to use the same methods that we used yesterday. The style is going to change today. I don't want our entities to think that portfolio committee is one and it's just enough alone. No. We love them and we want them to trust us and to believe in us as the portfolio committee. We are just doing what we are supposed to be doing, oversight. That's our core business. Oversight over the department and its entities. We're not going to be engaged in questions like yesterday. What we are going to do, we are going to take two presenters at a time, after which then we'll ask for clarity from those presenters. So that means when you make your presentation, you must express yourself. You must not read, you know. Ofunde, because that will then attempt us to ask questions. But when you talk for document, so that you should understand who are you, where do you come from, where are you going to. For instance, if you say we are Buyisa Ibeke, tell us who is Buyisa Ibeke, what are the responsibilities of Buyisa Ibeke, what is the relationship of Buyisa Ibeke as a government. What is it that the community are benefiting out of which I say? You know, the board. Who are members of the board? How long has the board been in existence? You know, such things. That's the kind of information that we need in a workshop. So that next time when we call you in, we should know what is the tata nabalina, and you should also know what is expected from you. I'm avoiding you could treat a workshop as if it's a portfolio committee. So yesterday we were dealing with the department. Of course, with the department, you're supposed to do that. Unfortunately, you're supposed to do that with them. But with the entities, they are going to change now today, and then the approach is going to differ from yesterday's approach. But I don't have any interest. I'm only pursuing my job, yeah. And I've discussed this matter with members of the committee, and then we think we must treat the workshop like a workshop. Then please don't spoil it. And we'll ask for clarities, of course. If there's something that you don't understand, we'll ask for clarities. We do have the documents. If there are questions that will come out of your documents, we'll call you back and come and make a proper presentation where we'll then engage in your presentation. Yeah, I did yesterday indicate that today we'll start with the Santas and then sit us in the Sunday. After that, Sautasa weather services, North Mangali, so in the way to be side back. Then, if there is time, and then we'll deal with the remainder of the department, then they are going to do oversight in the department. All right. We'll do then. Can I get a decision, Aile? Then let us then take Dr. Mabunda to give us then and tell us one sentence. Where do you come from? Where are you going to? And who are you?
Chairperson, thank you very much. Honorable members, colleagues, good morning. The presentation that I'll make, Chairperson, will be comprised of the following elements. The strategic plan as it stands is a high-level summary of extensive divisional business plans and each of our 22 parks has its own management plan, so I would have needed a special vehicle to bring all the documents, but we've got a summary. And our budget, obviously, document is about 200 pages, over 200 pages. So what you will get as a committee is just a high-level view of all those elements. The approach will be functional. We'll describe the functions in terms of conservation, tourism, finance, expanded public works projects, infrastructure, and a little bit in terms of support services, highlighting salient points on each. But Chairperson, I would like to give context. And it starts with our board, which was appointed last year on the 1st of April, chaired by Kuseni Lamini. Then he was Chairperson, he was CEO of Anglo, and now he's CEO of Old Mutual South Africa. Gert Draai, a retired engineer, but worked as a financial expert at APSA. Bongi Kunene, previously with the presidency. Jerry Vilagazi, CEO of BUSA, Business Unity South Africa. Professor Jerry Swan, who is the Dean of the Faculty of Veterinary Science at University of Pretoria. Professor Willem van Riet from PPF, NGO. Fundisile Mketeni, a DDG at the department. Sizega Renberg, a consultant and previous chair of weather services. Marius Dumont with Weber Wenza. That is the board, including myself as CEO and the chief financial officer, Temba Mblana. What are national parks? What's the business of national parks? Chair, they are a value system through which the nation looks at itself in terms of its values and appreciation of environment. They tell our stories and speak of our identity as a people and as a nation. We might be talking about the iconic Magnificent Seven Tuskers of the Kruger, the red sand dunes of the Kalahari, the kaleidoscope of the rainbow flowers of Namakoland, the majestic view of Table Mountain overlooking the Mother City, the night call of a jackal in Mokala under a Hakensteak tree, the ancestral gravesite of the Malemba on the Mapungubwe Hill, the Namafast trap dance of the Rechtersfeld people, or the roaring waterfalls at Ochrabis. These are scenes that are uniquely South African. They describe who we are, what we are about, and what our values are in terms of our appreciation of the environment. They are national symbols alongside the flag, the coat of arms, the national anthem, and the union buildings. Priceless assets that the country has. And we are, Chairperson, a template for many, many countries. And that is why, when it comes to conservation of the national parks and protected areas, countries look up to South Africa to lead the way. In a nutshell, that is what the national park system is about, and that is the context by way of introduction, Chairperson. The mandate, clearly the Protected Areas Act does provide a mandate for all protected areas in South Africa, but Chapter 5 of that Act specifically defines the Sun Parks mandate of conserving, protecting, and controlling these assets. But we also are subjected to the Public Finance Management Act as a section, a Schedule 3, Part A, public entity. In a nutshell, we manage 22 national parks, three of which are lumped as the Garden Route National Park, Tsukama, Naizna, and Wilderness. Our vision is to make this system the pride and joy of all South Africans, and history has it not only in South Africa but the rest of the world, that national parks or protected areas are built on the ashes of the indigenous homes of indigenous people. And as such, those people were excluded from that system. And that's what informs our vision, that we need to bring people back. We need to drive reconciliation. Parks are not islands isolated from their communities. We're not only managing biodiversity, Chairperson. Our mission is very clear. It is biodiversity, but also the beautiful landscapes that I've just described in my introduction, the associated heritage assets, and of course the sustainable use and benefits that should flow to people, in line with the motto adopted at the World Parks Congress in Durban of creating benefits beyond boundaries. But in all that we do, we abide by a transformation model that includes broad-based black economic empowerment, and to ensure that transformation of society is also reflected in the business that we do. It is not just a straightforward business, it's a very complicated system, Chairperson, because we have to manage a highly diverse institution. Its core business being conservation of this national park system. We run a small a law enforcement agency there on behalf of the minister. There's a big scientific research institution, and in addition to wildlife management. Communities indeed do benefit, because our job is to build constituencies. Through this system, we create jobs. And I will elaborate at a later stage in terms of the number of jobs that we have created. In terms of the delivery of the fruits of good conservation work, we use ecotourism as a vehicle and as a tourism strategy that is used, again, to fund the conservation system. Chair, in the little booklet, you have a map indicating our national parks. And out of all those national parks, the 22, only Ado, Tsitsikamma, Kgalagadi, Kruger, and Table Mountain generate a surplus. The rest of the parks generate a biodiversity profit. Financially, it's a loss. But indeed, we do not manage parks for profit or for losses. They are a microcosm of our values towards society, towards the environment. So if we were to look at them as profit and business making, we would actually close them down, but we would lose the ecosystem services and benefits that flow from the existence of those parks, in terms of them being carbon sequestration sites, in terms of them generating water from the catchment areas. One can think of the Zierberg Mountains, our only version of the Nyika Plateau with its folding mountains and forests. And in addition to all those functions, Chairperson, there's corporate governance, which is just normal in any business. And it's quite challenging to manage a multi-diverse institution like this one, where you've got antithesis. On the one side, we want to conserve. On the other side, we want to use, but use sustainably. And there's always a continuous tug of war between development and preservation. In terms of our standing as a country, we rank third in the world in terms of biodiversity richness. But what is important, Chairperson, is to look at the protected areas that are under state management. Just under 7.9 in total million, and nearly 4 million hectares of that are under our management, and the rest is managed by other agencies. SANParks is not the only player in the game. We share the space with others, and that translates to about 3.2% of the total surface of South Africa. It's a big estate to manage. If we were to put our dung beetles, crocs, snakes, and everything that moves on the balance sheet, would be the richest institution in the world. Back to the business of the functions, Chairperson. To make it easy, I've put aside the balanced scorecard approach and follow the traditional approach in terms of the storyline so that it makes sense to parliamentarians and people that are not dealing with this on a daily basis. We've got several objectives, and in our last workshop we generated close to 147 objectives just for conservation only. But in a given financial year you can only do so much, and these are the priorities. Our job is to improve the state of conservation. The estate itself needs to grow. But Chairperson, we have managed to add nearly 10,000 hectares. We have bioregional landscape linkages through the AB project down in Nogales. And we've brought in a number of contracted privately owned land into the national park system. And the targets for 2010-13 are as they are reflected, with special emphasis on succulents and namakaru. But the treasury cutbacks are going to cast aspersions on this initiative, because what treasury cut, Chairperson, as the DG explained yesterday, is money that was earmarked for buying land. We only pay landowners once the property has been registered by the deeds office, and that takes forever. It's not confined within a financial year. It can overlap. Negotiations with farmers are always difficult. We are always challenged in court and everywhere. Hence, it is not a clinical process that starts on the 1st of April, 1 year, and ends the following year on the 31st of March. But that's the money that was in the accrual account, which Treasury took away. And that has cut our plans in terms of acquiring land, and it will affect job creation, because it's through these new projects, the clearing and rehabilitation of this project of this newly acquired land, create an enormous number of jobs, and there we will be hamstrung. Making acknowledged contribution to conservation nationally and globally, Chairperson, scientists have a tendency of hiding information by simply mentioning six drivers of environmental change monitored. But these drivers involve a lot, and I will list them. We have a large mammals monitoring program. Never in the time or the history of the Kruger National Park, for example, and Ado to a certain extent, have we had so many large mammals, over 44,000 buffalo in the Kruger. Approximately 14,000, between 12 and 14,000 rhinos, the same number of elephants, if not more. That has a telling effect on the environment, because an elephant alone needs 120 liters of water per day, 300 kgs of forage in its tummy, and of course, to keep the attitude going. So that is a big problem. Our river's health has been on the news headlines, with crocodiles dying like flies in the Olifant River Gorge. But generally, our rivers are in a state of concern. You just look at reports by the Water Commission, you will see that we do have a challenge. And a rivers research program is one of those monitoring programs. And it involves both internal and external scientists. Restoration of degraded environments is a big job, particularly in neighboring community areas, because what happens outside the park has an impact inside the park. So it's useless to focus inside your borders and ignore what is happening in the catchment area. And that is where our rivers emanate from as well, Chairperson. Vegetation monitoring is very important, particularly with fixed-point assessments of certain areas. It's a method, a methodology that is used to a large extent in elephant management to show how heterogeneity of or the changes in the landscape have been achieved over a certain period of time. And that's crucial information that we need for decision making. And of course, the broader environmental scanning. All of these are ongoing, and the clearing of alien invasives, which really has a telling effect on our environment in terms of water conservation. These are ongoing programs, which we manage every year, and the fact they contribute to the level of knowledge. We also watch developments within the borders of our parks, in a certain radius of the parks, about 40, 50 kilometers. Hence, there is a concern, Chairperson, on the Mapungubwe development or the Verekoilere mining, 7 kilometers close to Mapungubwe, in terms of the impact that it will have on that World Heritage Site. Next slide. Research is an ongoing program. We had 258 research projects registered last year. In the scientific services business plan, these are detailed in terms of their purpose and who is involved in those research programs. And I didn't think it would be prudent to burden the committee with that scientific information, but suffice to say there is ongoing research. We draw researchers from within and also from research institutions around the country, Water Commission, CSIR, the Council for Geology, and many others to assist us, but we lead the way. We would never be able, Chairperson, to employ all the scientists. We strive to be a trusted scientific authority because our applied research is important in terms of decision making in the science management interaction continuum. Building constituencies is our job. We want communities to know what is it that we're talking about when we say there are national parks. In my travels abroad, I found people that didn't even know where South Africa is, but the minute I mentioned Table Mountain and Kruger National Park, they knew exactly where I came from. And it's important that we spread that even in our own communities, in the townships where we live. Hence, we have your Junior Ranger, Honorary Rangers program. We bring in scores of learners, over 150,000 that we brought, close to 142,000 last year. And we have flagship projects through which communities can sustainably harvest certain products, which are listed, thatch, timber, flour, and many others. Add to that list Mopaniwems for people in the north. We will not arrest them now for Mopaniwems. Next slide. Chair, resource protection has become a nightmare. I've just distributed the steps in terms of rhino poaching amongst parliamentarians. You will see that from 2008, a hockey stick effect started showing with the poaching of rhino. And to the comfort of this committee, no elephant has been poached since. Nothing has happened. Now, that shows we are dealing with organized crime. On Monday night, our team successfully arrested a Kenyan rhino horn dealer in Johannesburg. And as they were arresting him, his buyer, a Chinese national, was coming up the steps, and he knocked at the door and he walked into a trap, and we arrested them both. And that has helped us to get even more information, and there will be more arrests coming soon. Rhino poaching is a big problem worldwide in all rhino range states. The Sumatran rhino in Asia, only 300 are left. The Java species, almost extinct. And in Southern Africa, we sit with about 17,400 rhinos. And about only 400 to 500 or to 600, that's the estimate, are black rhinos. They are under siege because of the horn. It is said to be performing miracles in the east.
Mr. Mabunda, can you tell us about those miracles? About an idea? You know, Mr. Mabunda, don't provoke members, because I said I don't want to hurt him.
Chairperson, your word is my command. I will not elaborate on the miracles. But suffice to say that there is a rumor that a Vietnamese minister made an announcement that he was cured of cancer with a concoction involving rhino horn. That was 2 years ago, and we've seen the spike going up, and Vietnamese have been arrested, including staff in the diplomatic offices here. And also, of course, that it is a very good... it's very good for the libido. Perhaps the announcement, Chairperson, should be, if you take rhino horn, it lowers the libido. That will have an effect, a desired effect. But we... This year we've lost in total, the minister gave us permission, as the DG alluded to yesterday, to coordinate all these activities, law enforcement activities throughout the country. So the SANParks officials are not only working at SANParks, they are assisting the whole country in terms of dealing with the rhino horn and abalone poaching. So far we've lost 38, and the stats, 38 rhinos. As a country, we've lost 11 in the Kruger National Park. Gauteng has 2. I don't know where they are. Perhaps somewhere in Sandton, Limpopo. Northwest has more. The onslaught is also on privately owned land. But Chair, this is really a serious situation, which has prompted us to enlist the services and the assistance of the Army Reserve. The process is underway that we will be able to use ex-veterans from the Liberation Army who could not be absorbed into the SANDF and also the Army Reserve to assist us in fighting this case. We hope that will bring the desired results. It's a two-pronged approach. We're going for foot soldiers, but also the dealers in high places and clutch offices. Tourism, next slide please. Chair, as I indicated, I'm not going to deal with the operations parks and Kruger because they actually implement what I've already presented at high level in terms of the different functions. But members will be free to ask questions. Tourism performance, although we've experienced a revenue growth of 13.3%, we have not done that well. Table Mountain here is bleeding in terms of visitors. Because they depend on the international market, and as such, we have problems there. We have challenges because of the recession. The 13.3 growth rate has been achieved as a result of rate increases, and also inventory that was increased because of property or units coming online from the expanded public works program that we've finished. An interesting one, Chairperson. We did say we are serious about transforming even the guest profile of people going to parks by making sure that people who previously never had an opportunity to go to these parks can also access them. Our percentage of black visitors, because we do take stats of black visitors as they come at the gates, you don't have to explain that you are black, we can see that you are black. And then we take that information. It gets channeled in. 25% of all visitors are black. Since the Constitutional Court ruling, they are black. business development, as I indicated, it's very difficult to manage to strike a balance between conserving and using. But we have no option. We are probably the only conservation agency in the world that is generating 85% of its operational revenue from tourism. None of the others that I work with do that. In fact, it's the opposite. They get 95% from government and they generate 5%. But there's always a competition in terms of how do we then do this development. So development in parks is controlled by what we call a conservation development framework. Previously, it was called the Recreational Opportunity Zoning System, or the ROS plan. And that indicates to us areas of less biodiversity importance which can be developed in any park. And then we have a template. It's our IDP system. So through that, we look at possible opportunities. And one of those has been the Malelane, for lack of a better word, for a facility that provides all services. We call it a hotel. But it will not be a hotel like this one that we have. It will be a safari hotel informed by the architecture that applies to the setting, which retains the sense of place, the ambience and character of a conservation destination. So it is not going to be a Hyatt. It is not going to be a Sheraton. It will be a rest camp with a difference that provides services. There will be no self-service there. Guests will not be driving around. They will be checked in at the gate, leave their cars, and will then transport them to the hotel and take care of them until they leave. So Malelane Hotel is one of those. And then we've got several of these that we are working on, some of which have been achieved. Others are still in the pipeline. And we hope that two projects by 2013 will be completed. I must also add, Chairperson, that it's not possible to replace the money that Treasury has cut from our budget overnight. It's a long, painful process, one that should take care of the wilderness qualities of the system that we are managing and the need for public enjoyment. So we're not going to... If I put it differently, national parks are not for sale. They will not be for sale. We will not simply because we don't have money go out and do things that are incongruent with the conservation ideals. The need to improve customer services and reduce the number of complaints in a proactive customer services approach is paramount in our tourism department, and we will continue doing so. Lastly, Chair, this was not available at the time when we did the report, but 2010, we are indeed ready. We had an agreement with Match, and we gave them 30% of our inventory. They couldn't sell it. They only sold about 10% of that 30% when we inquired last month. And then last week, Wednesday, we took it back, and we put it online again on Thursday. And Friday morning, it was all sold. We work in a price-sensitive environment. If you put up your prices because you want to compensate for whatever, you reap the fruits of not selling anything. Match put the price 3 times higher, and people couldn't afford. So we bring it back to net. The reason why national parks are affordable, it is because we want to promote access. This is a heritage system that we are managing. It's not a business. So 2010, accommodation has been sold. Chair, as per my earlier indication, I'm not going to touch operations. They implement all the things that I've said under those two major broad functions, but members are free to ask questions. I'll move to the finance slide. Very important. We are in a recession. One of our key objectives is effective budget management. And we realized that we were in a recession, it couldn't be a recession and it couldn't be business as usual, and we instituted a cost curtailment exercise which brought about a saving of 30 million. We cut out frills, use of consultants, no consultants, we employ people that have been to school so they can do the job. Business class travel, everybody in the asshole of the plane, we cut excessive use of vehicles and many things, Chairperson. So, no, I mean every manager, official that we have employed has been to school, therefore there's no need for them to use consultants.
Also, they qualify, they've got the required.
They've got qualifications, so there's no need. In fact, if you need a consultant, then it's a skill that we don't have. So the first thing that we ask is, you've been to school, yes. You studied for the job that you have, yes. So do it. Just do it. And that is the approach. In the drive to improve governance, Chairperson, we are aware of the King III and new accounting standards. And it's one of those things that we felt there we need a consultant to help us. But the consultant that we have is the one that is our internal auditor. And we have gone through a process of reviewing all those processes in terms of improving risk management and governance. So that when we say we have an unqualified audit report, we don't just mean financial, but performance against set objectives, all the objectives throughout the spectrum. Procurement, supply chain management, and that is where our BEE procurement and functions lie. We are standardizing all commodities and managing demand management even in a much better way. I think I should not miss this one, Chairperson. Leveraging technology as a strategic enabler is very important in our business. We conduct reservations. We would like a system that talks to HR, to finance, that talks to our surveys, the surveys that we conduct in terms of customer views. That system should be on a broader business process management platform with our eSmart approach. So we are actually building a bus, and in that bus we will have all kinds of services all talking to each other. At the moment the systems are not talking to each other. Imagine if we would have a crash of the system. We would sit in a quandary of sorts. But luckily there is a disaster management or recovery plan that keeps our information off-site. But that process is big. And that is where we also use the help of consultants, because we don't employ people with this kind of qualifications. Chair, the budget I will leave for the CFO in particular. That's what he specializes in. And move to expanded public works projects and take the first four objectives. Very clearly, we've created quite a number of jobs through the expanded public works program. The advantage of this program is that it helps us to keep our infrastructure up to standard. The roads, the tourism facilities, fences, and other non-profit generating assets are managed through this. But we measure it in terms of person's days and also expenditure. We also look at the procurement. The numbers are quite impressive, Chair. We plan to spend, in terms of expenditure, 70 million, and we achieved 78 million. The person days were supposed to be 279, but due to some of the contracts being cancelled because of shoddy work, we had to reduce the number. But procurement, almost 78% of all contracts went to black-owned companies. The rest of the companies are joint ventures between black and white companies. So it's 100%. benefiting. And we have killed, we've actually produced people there, for example, in terms of the construction programs that we have, who are now employed as contractors for maintenance of our facilities. These are community-owned companies. But in a nutshell, that is the contribution that the Expanded Public Works Project does to us. Not looking after infrastructure, Chairperson, has a debilitating effect on our business. You can't be competitive. And as such, we have a historical backlog that we try and address. It would really assist us if we were to have an injection of 150 million per year just to look after infrastructure. But we don't have that. However, we are very grateful of the department's intervention in terms of infrastructure allocations, which have seen us achieving those achievements that are listed on the slide. But I would like to comment that the program performance itself is 93% of all funding that has been allocated before the end of this financial year now. We are at 93%. The reason why we can't be at 100% is because, again, we had contractors that were cutting corners, and we don't hesitate to terminate a contract if people are not playing according to the rules. And yeah, that is really the information on infrastructure, and there's one example of a new infrastructure at Agalas National Park. Briefly on human resources, Chairperson, I'm not going to take more time. This is a support service, but suffice to say that we are well on course in terms of equity, critical positions. Vacancy rate is at 6% of the 3,482 staff, but that's not threatening the optimal functioning of the institution. That 6% is in the process of being filled, but some of them will be frozen because of the recent financial problems that we've experienced. Skills development, we brought in 215 interns last year, and all of those, most of them have been absorbed, others have been able to find jobs elsewhere, and we intend continuing doing so. On labor relations, on the next slide, I'll leave the rest for questioning. On the next slide in labor relations, really it's very important. We have won all the cases, 100% of the cases that have been referred to the CCMA in the last financial year, but also in the last 5 years, we've not lost a case there. When managers and supervisors are well trained, are working within the regulations of the institution, you have less problems around these cases. But conflict is a given; it will always be there. Management sees this side of the table, staff sees the other side under the table, and they are able to pick up those kind of problems. But it is how we manage these things that makes a difference. Communications, very important. Reputation management and image of the organization is very important. We always have people taking pot shots at the organization about various things, about our core businesses, management of elephants, rhino, poaching, and the like. And it's important to constantly release information in a proactive manner so that you can turn horror movie stories into fairy tale ending stories by making information more available in the mainstream. A good example is the racism case on Table Mountain, where AfriForum eventually ended up realizing that there was fabrication of the whole story. But that is as far as we can go in terms of communication. As I said, it's a support service. And it does help us also in terms of creating awareness through specific interventions such as the South African National Parks Week and the Kudu Awards, our own version of the Oscars in conservation. Chair, I'll then hand over to the Chief Financial Officer, Mr. Mabilane, to speak to the committee about the finances of SANParks.
Thank you, Chair. We have submitted a break-even budget as required by the PSMA. Mainly, our revenue sources consist of four revenue sources. The first four, as listed in the presentation, conservation fees, concession fees, retail gross profit, and tourism income. Conservation fees mainly includes entry fees into the park and income from our wildcat program. Concession fees includes mainly income from our business development program. Retail gross profits, those are our fuel stations in all parks and some shops. And then tourism income is accommodation, camping activities, walks, drive, and other tourism activities inside parks. So in this budget, Chair, our revenue will increase with 12.6 next year, mainly due to rate increases. And then one of our revenue sources obviously comes from government support, mainly with operational grants, the road grants, and income from the Department of Forestry for the Nizna forestry areas. Our total income as an average, therefore, will increase with 10%, which is really above the current CPIX. As we are expected, Chair, to achieve break-even, our total expenditure, therefore, will grow with the same percentage of 10%. HR represents 55% of our total expenditure as agreed with the department. Other cost drivers include maintenance costs, depreciation, and operating costs. And then we have another revenue source, although not much. It is income from our investment through our efficient daily cash management. And then lastly, we have capital grants from the department, which has to do with land acquisition, although cut, but the land still exists. And then revenue from sale of fauna and flora. So as you can see, Chair, our bottom line is a break-even budget as expected. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much, Dr. Mabula and your team. Before we take funding, I will give a percentage for clarity. If there's anything that was not clear, then I'll give it to members. Ms. Lavo?
No, sorry.
Come again?
Yes.
Anything that is not clear? Of anything that we don't understand, Mama?
Jefferson, thank you very much. How I wish one day I can be so articulate as my son, that is David Mabunda. I had quite a number of questions in secretary to ask, but now I cannot, because everything has been done fine. Really and truly, I just had quite a number. But now, nothing. I can. No clarity. That is very, very good. But the only one thing that I want to clarify. within the park, the Kruger National Park, and how does that one operate? Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I have a question of clarity. Dr. Mabunda, you mentioned briefly Mapungubwe and the mine 7 kilometres away from it, which has now got a new order mining right from the Minister of Mineral Resources. In way of clarity, could you talk us through the threat that new order mining rights have to your parks, particularly in the north of the country? Because there is, and you know that I afforded you correspondence about this before, a huge amount of land that is being traded up there at the moment, farm agricultural land being bought by consortiums which are backed by mining houses. And you said, you yourself said that you have serious concerns about the quality of the water, which is presumably mainly from sewage effluent flowing into your park. I mean, the next threat, of course, is acid mine drainage flowing into your park as well. So what active steps is Sandparks taking in order to, where appropriate, oppose mining applications through the common process, which is all that is, quite frankly, available to you at this time? And are you doing enough, actually, to publicly state those positions? So in essence, to go beyond just commenting, but actually just to do that quite, and I mean this genuinely, impressive speech which you started your presentation off about how beautiful and what it all means and our collective memory, because that's true, and why isn't that being used when you guys actually oppose or comment on activities which are quite frankly destructive to your core business?
Dr. Martina?
Thank you, Chair. As a rural man, I'll speak for my constituency. First, I want to thank you very much for saying that your law enforcement agencies are not arresting our people for helping themselves to Mopane Wems in the Popo. But I'm also not yet satisfied, because you said nothing about the traditional healers. Because there are some medicinal plants that are found in your parks in Limpopo. And these traditional healers, when digging for these plants, they use very serious weapons like eggs and picks. And you might mistake them for these illegal hunters or poachers. So how do you intend dealing with this situation? Because these are very important people in our society. Secondly, you did mention the fact that 78% of your contracts are awarded to black-owned companies. But I want more details about that, because sometimes by just saying black, it creates problems. You know, in the areas of Beggarsford, where these mining activities are happening, almost 99% of the BEE who are partnering with these black mining giants are from Gauteng. They're not from those areas. So if you are saying that being awarded to black contractors, do you mean just black by being black or the people from those surroundings?
I am promoting
for it. Okay, thank you. I was very keen to hear that the parks, and we've heard before, that the parks are doing so exceptionally well. I can remember being at a presentation years ago, and Dr. Neil Malan, in fact, saying that conservation would never survive in South Africa if it could not pay for itself. And it was a very unpopular statement at the time,
because people felt that you had to conserve for the sake of conserving, but unless it actually pays, it's not going to survive. So we haven't got there quite yet, but as you say, we're doing particularly well, so congratulations on that. My question, Chair, is just on the MK veterans. It's rather interesting that NCM was also looking at you using MK veterans, or are using MK veterans to assist with policing of poaching. You now are also saying using MK veterans for policing of poaching. And I'm just interested to know how this works. Do the MK veterans form a pool of labour from which government draws, or government preferentially draws when it needs assistance? I'm not singling them out for any other reason than that there are very many unemployed people in the country, and there might be people who are better fitted for purpose, and what you need to look for is people who are fit for purpose. So I'm very surprised that you're not following a process to identify people who are properly fit for process and not just targeting directly MK veterans. And I'd appreciate comments on that. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to make this comment to Mr. Mabunda to say we did go to school, so he must not fear giving us the scientific jargon information. I'm sure we'll be able to fix it next time. On industrial transformation, I think this question is sort of linked to the Honourable Matele on the BEE. I think it will be important, maybe not necessarily today, that when you come next time to give presentation, that it will be important for us to actually have a breakdown, the geographical spread and the gender composition and the number of SMEs that we are actually talking about, because we're talking about triple BEE and we're also talking about the SMEs. So if we can be able to have the geographical spread of that and actually the breakdown also on gender and young people and disabled, on all those people that are benefiting. Because I think it is easy for people to say 78% is benefiting, and when you need to go down into detail, you actually fall short. I think other questions are actually covered. I think on that one, there are other veterans from other organizations and also from the old standup. Maybe it was important actually to understand why on choosing one.
Thank you, Chairperson. Mine would be to request the institution, that is SANPARK, to give us a policy on dealing with privately owned game reserves around or inside the national parks, like in the Kruger. A policy which deals with the control of hunting. Because we are talking about poaching. And I suspect that after you took down the fence bordering your national parks, surely those people are helping themselves because they've got licenses hunt. How do you control that? I hope I'm not inventing this because it has been in the media. I thought you would brief us. That's one of the challenges which is facing your institution. And lastly, can you talk to us about the future? Because what you have told us is more or less what we read almost every day in the annual report. Where do you see the future of this And lastly, are you ready if one day this country is hit by severe drought? Because you've already alluded to the fact that the water shortage is also a challenge. Where will you take these animals to? you have agreements, for instance, with other countries where you can relocate them for a specific period. Thank you.
Thanks, Chair. Through you, I'd like to ask the doctor, there is a large land restitution claim ongoing at Kruger Park. The department, I think, is agricultural or rural development, are desperately trying to come to some compromise on that. How far has that claim progressed? Can you pass any comment on that? Thank you.
But we'll need to declare it.
I said I'd like to say
anything.
Okay.
I just want to declare it.
So you can just let us go on and ask us no more than we.
I'm saying, Mama, you vote in your school. You vote in your school. You have decided to ask questions. Instead of planting, and your members of parliament get the right to do so. As I'm saying that we carry on the way you are doing. The Chairperson doesn't mind, actually. All right, well, okay.
Chairperson, thank you. I was interrupted by your mama. Chairperson, Chairperson, I'm just asking about those parts that are in the rural areas and controlled by provinces, which means they are not visible in terms of operation and so on. I just want to know, how does the National Parks Institution assist in that regard? Thank you.
I'll give to you, Dr. Mahunda, in your dream, and then after your responses, we'll take Sandy. I'm not going to take other clarities, no. Clarities, questions.
Chairperson, thank you very much. Honorable members, the question relating to the school in Kruger, we do have a primary school in Kruger, situated at Skukuza. We also have a My Acre of Africa Environmental Education Project, or a center, on just next to Pabini Gate. The school definitely is managed by the Department of Education, the curriculum that is followed. We simply provide buildings for the school. And then for children that are beyond primary school education, those go to neighboring towns and we provide transport to those kids to school. So the school is there and it benefits in various ways in terms of activities. We also sponsor it where they experience shortfalls. Honorable Morgan, the Mapungubwe Vele Koelari challenge is a challenge for all of us, civil society in particular. The license that we are querying was issued by the Department of Minerals, and the difficulty is that we are a state institution, and therefore the two ministers must follow an intergovernmental approach in terms of resolving the issue between the two of them. However, we have publicly registered our concern as an institution which is mandated to manage the national park, and we've raised issues around the water rights that they haven't actually, Vele Koelari hasn't applied for water rights. If they've applied, those have not been granted. But we also want to understand how they will use the water and the waste flowing from that institution. Siwa is a problem, but generally the whole pollution, environmental impact through the dust that will come from the mining activity there. We don't have information from the plans, the environmental impact assessment that Vele Koelari has conducted that is addressing succinctly or adequately all the concerns that we've raised. So we just feel that we've been brushed aside. Every time we put a concern, we respond, we've been brushed aside. Hence, the civil society organizations who have been part of this process, EWT, PPF, and many others, have now decided to instruct this Legal Resources Center to lead the whole initiative in a court case. We hope that will force the developers to look adequately at all the concerns that we have raised. So that is what we have done. And in the meantime, we are also preparing a scenario as to what will happen after, because there is a possibility that the mining will go ahead, and therefore we should be ready as well with those consequences in terms of how to deal with it. And that process is underway. I'm not in a position to express in terms of these are, you know, APC, to give definite steps or contingency plans that will get. But the process is underway that in case the mining happens, what then? How are we going to manage the situation? The Honorable Matebula, the traditional healers, not only in Limpopo, but traditional healers throughout the country, everywhere where we have them, where we have our parks in terms of the geographical spread, have an arrangement with our existing management in parks, where harvesting under the guidance of the park and our sustainable use policy of specific medicinal plants is allowed. In Kruger specifically, where the demand is great, we have nurseries that we have created for that purpose. The nurseries collect seed, I've forgotten the other. Well, they collect all the seeds and whatever plants and cultivars there that are then used and planted for the purpose of providing medicinal plants. But they also want bones of animals. And so the roadkills that happen, unfortunately, we do pick them up, put them in the fridges, and then if there is a genuine request for that, we do make that available to traditional healers for purposes of healing and not bewitching people. I don't know, sir, but when the committee, I believe, Chairperson, the committee will visit us in the near future, would really love to put all these things that we're talking about on the table. Yeah. We would be very happy to make this information and to see these facilities where these things are kept and go to the nurseries see the kind of plants. In some instances, we gain a lot of valuable knowledge because we don't know the use of these plants. And then when the traditional healers come and request for them, we learn a lot from that. It contributes to the indigenous knowledge that we have as a program in terms of people and conservation, or the old social ecology program. 78%, Honorable Ndute, of all these contracts, I think the question is similar to what has been asked by Honorable Matebe. Beg your pardon. We are very happy. The CFO was whispering in my ear here that, in fact, because he manages the supply chain department, that information is available. We can provide it even as we speak now. We can send an SMS and ask for that information to be emailed. It is available. It breaks down all the information in terms of the geographical spread is a given. It's where the parks are. And then the number of SMMEs, the gender, all that is is contained. What I'm not sure of is young people. I'll have to check on that one. But the rest of the stuff, because this question was asked previously, so we did prepare for that. But that information is available. We'll make it available. We can get the emails of the specific, but I think the whole committee can receive the information. Honorable Walomisa, the issue of privately owned reserves sharing borders with us is now 25 years in existence, particularly in Kruger. When that was allowed, the policy did not provide for the kind of checks and balances that you are requesting that they should be provided. It simply allowed removal of the fence, movement of animals across the boundaries, and some of the neighbors, the nature reserves, in the Sunny Sands, not Sunny Sands, in the Kimbavati, APNR associated private nature reserve area, Balule up to the north. Some of those lodges have hunting quarters, and the hunting permits are issued by Limpopo provincial government. We've had problems. There's been a public outcry. There was a court case which ruled in their favor on the basis of information available at the time. It ruled in the favor of the hunters or the hunting lodges. However, my view is that this is a matter of national concern, because it's national assets that are involved. And as such, the initiative should come from this committee to institute a process via the department where we look at amending legislation, so that if a privately owned contractual park is linked to a national park, there should be no hunting there. I think for us to avoid a situation where every year we will come to the committee and the committee will be unhappy, and we are also unhappy about it, Honorable Holomisa, we are also unhappy about it. We need to have our act amended in terms of contractual parks and specifically address the issue of hunting there. And then that will settle the score. The future of this institution, I do talk about it quite a lot, and sometimes I think one just gets carried away. The luxury of contiguous parks achieved through evictions and land grabbing by proclamation is over. We will not have in this democratic dispensation a similar process that established the national parks that we have. Future national parks will be managing corridors, because land is hotly contested by various land uses for survival and also to address growth. We battled to buy land. And by the time, like now, we will have a 3-year break without buying land, we will not be able to purchase the targeted areas or pieces of land that we have in sight. By the time we get money, they will be gone, or they will be occupied. So the 21st century parks will be, you'll have a town, you'll have a hotspot in between, a residential area, a squatter camp, a farm, and all of that will be linked through landscape connectivity to save the biodiversity that we so treasure. However, existing parks have a challenge. Unless they are in the mainstream calls of the general public, unless the public see benefits in them, they will continue to be challenged. And hence we have a people and conservation program that is not seeking just to provide mopani worms and this and fetch, but it is seeking to establish a constituency where the sense of appreciation and environmental romanticism that I spoke about exudes within that community. And that is really the future, how I see it. To get there, we need money. To get there, we need support, and we need a thorough public education program. We have started on those, the foundations of those public education programs. It will take time in a society where the large majority of people were excluded from this wildlife romanticism. So in a nutshell, Honorable Chair, that is the future of this institution. And financially, we need to continue to identify relevant projects that will generate revenue. But there will never be a solution or a situation where tourism will be a panacea to all conservation challenges. We do have challenges with existing PPPs. We have to save them from collapsing from time to time. They are not an absolute solution to the challenge. So we'll continuously look for opportunities. Disaster may strike. It did strike at Tsavo and Amboseli in East Africa, drought, but also lack of understanding, management, modeling, and monitoring of the key drivers that I spoke about earlier in my presentation. Those did not take place, and people could not read the future. And ultimately, animals in those parks perished. The last were the elephants. They were the last because of their size and their resilience. But the rest of things went first. Now, in the event that that happens, we have, Honorable Chair, over the years, since I think the 1960s, not only South African National Parks or the National Parks Board then, but Natal Parks Board and many others were involved in a process of sending animals to different parts of the world, notably zoos, where we sent black rhino, white rhino, and many others. But also I also understand that there's a report at CITES which is going to confront us where South African rhinos, there's about 141 South African rhinos in China, on a rhino horn harvesting farm. I don't know how they got there, but they are there. And we are being confronted about that, Alf. So it's something that we will need to deal with. But there's been an exercise of moving animals around the country in habitats where they occurred. We already know from the climate change report where disaster is looming. And those we have avoided. We've got a breeding program for clean buffalo. So if disaster strikes, it will not strike the whole country, but it will strike certain areas. And then we would have saved other animals in another place and we'll be able to bring them back into the system. Land claims in Kruger, DJ, I think at our last meeting there was a breakthrough. We were told by the land claims, the chief land claims commissioner, that the settlement that cabinet reached on the 3rd of December 2008 option is the one that government is going with, which means then there will be no restoration of title, but there is a need to ensure that communities benefit optimally from the Kruger National Park, but the rest of the other parks will be dealt with in the normal restitution process. Rural parks, Honorable Kosana, are controlled by provinces because conservation is a concurrent function. But there are ongoing relationships which are not regulatory with our, I'm now wary of using sister conservation agencies, Chairperson, after yesterday's discussion about the sisterhood. But we are working with provinces in various ways to address shortfalls. But the problem is that parks around the world, including those of our provinces, do not generate money. They were not created for that.
However, where there are opportunities, there is some contribution that comes through. They spend most of their money or budgets on salaries, and then there's nothing left to maintain the estate. It is something that the department is looking at in a national context. Thank you, Chairperson. I don't know whether I've left out some.
Perhaps I did not address myself properly on the law enforcement bolstering our anti-poaching program. We approached the SANDF Reserve Force under that umbrella because the country's army is small and then it is complemented by the Reserve Force. Now, under the Reserve Force, you have various army formations from the previous regime and the current regime. And through this Army Reserve system, we were then able to identify or present our need, and then we had to look for funds. We are still looking for those funds to draw a certain pool of people to assist us. So they will come from different formations, not only from MK. There will be many other army formations from the reserve army reserve. So we are dealing with the army reserve, not the veterans themselves. Under the army reserve, there's different formations there.
Clear. You are saying it's clear. I hear the motion. Oh, I think. What is it? I think after debate and everything, because we are going to debate with the budget, you know. That's the reason why we are all here. Because we must convince Parliament that we are leading a living sector. And you know, before I joined this sector, Mamuzikela, are you going to be the borders in the sector? Yeah, Mamuzikela. Before I joined this sector, it was so boring. After I water affairs with no environment and don't you, oh I coming in and don't the office. You know. But the one I missed a lot. So interesting. You are dealing with, issues of life, you know. You are dealing with our lives, actually, you know. Yeah. So I'm saying that it's very interesting. And since this new parliament, you are my witness. Everybody wants to hear what you are saying. They would say that, Mrs. Soju, we are wearing our hot jacket today because your people said it's going to be very cold today, but very hot. So they are here. They are going to respond on my behalf to that question. It's a pity this thing is not in Parliament. I'm sure that if they knew that you are here and then the workshop is in Parliament, we didn't have a venue that would have taken everyone. Because when I told them yesterday, because they wanted to know who's in the group, people the whole day, I told them. They said, Balaka and the weather. Yes, yes. I Mama said, you don't get the price, you know? Yes. All right. Thanks, Tanima Bunda. I might say that I agree with members who said that this was a very lively presentation. It was very good, more than we expected, actually. It was very, very good, I must say. So please let other people not spoil it.
Let's follow the same. The standard is same, yes. But I'm worried. Are there women in this thing of yours? Yes, Chair. They are. And I also support them. Dr. Razina Omar was with us, and he went through the school of conservation at Sun Parks, and And the DG decided that she has really earned her wings, and hence she has moved. Yes, there are women, and next time we only brought a very small delegation of the two of us because of court curtailment. But next time I can bring her all back.
Why?
Because you have just credit yourself.
No. You know, if I make some pass the land, we lose a lot, but by the time they come, we'll be born. You see? So the best, let them start, you know, so that we should expect the others to be like them. Others, if we start with people who don't know whether they are going or they are coming, we'll think that they are also the same. You see? Yeah. And you know, when members are bored, the amount of money and buy a debt.
Yes.
When they're bored, they slash at you, don't even listen to you, they just slash at you. You know, yeah. So I think it's good that we started with them, but it was not because I liked Dr. Mabunda, it's because of the program, the way it is. Not me. Let us take Sandy again. Sandy, don't spoil it. Let's take Sandy.
Thank you, Honorable Chair, Honorable Members. No pressure. To be as exciting and interesting as my colleague Dr. Mabunda, very difficult act to follow. I listened yesterday to much of the debate and made some changes, I think, in the presentation. One of the appeals made by honourable members was, is this a workshop or is this a presentation? So it's become a little bit of a hybrid, honourable chair, and hopefully I don't think I can reach the excitement of Dr. Mabunda, but I will try. The outline of my presentation, and my colleague Moketli Kwasi, who is the CFO, will help me with the finances. And the outline of the presentation is such, I think that you've got the hard copies, so I won't go through that. But one of the reasons why...
Tanya, you have already spoiled it. Because we said you must tell us who you are. We have a board. How many of you are here? Who are they? You know, those things. And
sorry, sir. Okay. My name is Tanya Alonso. I'm the CEO. And accompanying me is Ms. Carmel Ndizo, who is head of research and knowledge behind me here. And also accompanying me is the CFO, Mr. Moketsi Kwasi. The board information is in my presentation, so is the number of people in the organization and what it does. So I'm hoping that that will help you.
Okay. Is that okay, Jay?
Yes.
Yeah, thank you.
So please do excuse me if I'm speaking to those who already know, but sometimes we have to explain again because of the complexity of this institution. I think Dr. Mabunda has an easy job of it because he can use elephants and, you know, protected areas and all that kind of thing. And ours is more a mixture of operation and intellectual work. It's a mixture of those two things there. So what we used to be was the National Botanical Institute, and the most visible manifestation of our work really was the gardens. And of course, Kirstenbosch and Walter Sisulu and Pretoria Gardens are some of those gardens which are iconic, and people remember us for that. But underpinning or the back end of it, as we change from being the Botanical Institute to being the Biodiversity Institute, the fact of the matter is that our mandate was expanded quite enormously, and we moved from operations and conservation and estate management to research, to knowledge management, to policy advice, not only in botany but biodiversity in general, and not only in species work and species science work, but more complex work such as ecosystem and the human management of biomes, etc. So in brief, Chair, if we go to the next slide, our vision is to bring biodiversity richness to all South Africans. And that vision tries to encapsulate all the work that we do in a kind of a strap line. So we champion the exploration, the conservation, use, appreciation, and enjoyment of South Africa's exceptionally rich biodiversity for all people. And may I say, in the drive to deliver hard jobs and economic growth, what we sometimes forget is just the beauty and the spiritual upliftment that we can get from our nature and our beauty, and that's one of our aims. So in brief, this is a slide that I juggled with yesterday after listening to some of the inputs made. So in brief and overarchingly and in a simpler form as possible, our role is to lead the national biodiversity research agenda, to lead the provision of biodiversity knowledge and information, to give policy advice and support that is based on evidence-based science, to manage the National Botanical Gardens, and we now have got 9, we had 8 a year or so ago, we now have 9, as windows to our biodiversity, particularly for tourism and education, but also because of the nature of where they're located, in peri-urban areas, it's an opportunity for urban people to get in touch with nature. One of the problems with Dr. Mabunda's park is that you often have to travel far to it, and we aim to open your eyes to biodiversity close to home, a bus ride from home. The other role that we have is to run ecosystem and biome-based restoration and rehabilitation programs, and here with a particular focus on creating green jobs, and I'm sure you would know that we run the Working for Wetlands project, for example, which is a highly successful award-winning program that creates enormous amount of jobs. The other very interesting area that we work on is to develop best practice models on how to manage biodiversity better. So those are projects such as CAPE, which is quite well known, grasslands, the Succulent Karoo program, the thicket program in the Eastern Cape. These are some of the programs we run on the ground. And then a new area, which I think my colleagues, when I made a presentation before, might be interested in, I know they are, is that to lead the development of the National Biodiversity Human Capital Development Strategy. I'll talk a little bit more about this, but this is so important for the sustainability going forward of the sector, both for all of us who play in the sector, including those who manage parks and work in the zoological area, etc. Very important, the Human Capital Development Strategy. And STANLEY's role is to lead it not just for itself, but for the whole of the biodiversity sector. So it's a very, very interesting and important role that we play, and I'll talk about it a little bit later. Just to give you a depiction of our structure as from a management perspective, we have a board, a CEO, myself, Tanya Abramser, Carmel and Visa, who is acting head on all the content side, Ms. Yolisa Koyo, who is on the conservation, estate, and corporate services side, and the CFO, who seems to have no name, that is Mr. Mokesi Kwasi, but we have changed that, added Mr. Mokesi Kwasi. To give you a little idea of the staff profile, to put it in context, we're only 720 people. We have a good mix between male and female, Honorable Chair, you might notice. And our disabled staff in particular has been a challenge, and we have been really working on that. So this is to give you some information, but it's in your pack. Another piece of information that you requested, Chair, this is the STANLEY board. Mr. Tami Sokutu has a master's degree actually from University of the Western Cape, I think many, many decades ago. He's obviously a lapsed scientist, though, but has been working in the public and the private sector. Trish Hanekom, I think you might also know, has been head of department in Gauteng Conservation, so she also has a conservation attribute. Mr. Tony Frost comes from WWF originally. Ms. Dingaan, who is the HR head of Tongaat, Yula Tongaat Sugar, who is a long in the tooth HR person. Mr. Somyo, who is an executive mayor from the Eastern Cape and also has experience and involvement in biodiversity. Ms. Montgomery, who is a journalist, a writer on it. Professor Ojungu, who is at the Vaal University and is in fact a professor of science and biodiversity. Ms. Pius, who is a DDG representing DST, and Mr. Mketeni representing DEET and myself. That's the board. So the brief that we were given, and I could see that maybe sometimes it doesn't go down so well, but the brief that we were given is to highlight our corporate strategic plan, and that's what I prepared, but I hope that in between my comments will help you understand some of the challenges that we face in this. So we want to position ourselves to harness biodiversity capacity and be recognized as the first port of call around knowledge and information. And we also do this through in six key result areas. Understanding biodiversity and understanding bioadaptation to climate change, develop models for integrated biodiversity management, run our gardens, policy advice, develop a managed network and do the human capital development, and have effective systems and processes to make us do all of that. So understanding biodiversity and bioadaptation to climate change. I think one of the great achievements between the department and ourselves is to develop the notion of having a research agenda that doesn't necessarily prescribe scientists in this country and pushes them into some kind of prison, but actually sets a sort of roadmap in order that as a developing country with limited resources and limited skills, that we harness all these skills into a roadmap. And that's what the department and Sandy particularly is leading, the roadmap to harness and use these skills and resources better, to avoid duplication. And that doesn't mean that we want to reduce innovation of science. So it's a very, very thin line between direction and control. And that research strategy is really important. It is a research strategy process that China, for example, has asked us to come and talk about how we do it and how is it done. Because research and prioritization of research and managing of research, I think, in this environment is key for a successful science nation, a nation based on science innovation. So it's very important. We're learning for the world on this, and it's been really important role that we're playing. The other area is a subsector of that research agenda is the issue of bioadaptation and climate change. And you might have known and you will see that there's been some press around the science behind some of the climate change work. And some of our staff sit on the IPCC, for example. And so the issue of veracible, evidence-based research is we take it very, very seriously, and particularly in support of our department. Again, in this area, it's a popular area. Suddenly, the trend of the year, climate change. And so there are many players in the country, many researchers in the country, in universities, etc. And one of our roles is to harness those researchers into also a bit of a roadmap about where are the priorities around research in bioadaptation. As an organization ourselves, we also want to focus on what we are very good at and what we are best at. So we are developing a biodiversity, bioadaptation and climate change research focus between the department and ourselves around this. But already I think there are some of our scientists and some of our models and information already global class information. Point number three is when I first arrived at this organization, I was snowed under all these acronyms that seem to be in this sector. But the National Biodiversity Strategy and Action Plan was a plan that was developed about 2 or 3 or 4 years ago. And really it brought together everybody to understand what is the actions we need to take. And Sandy is working particularly in developing and assisting policy in order to fulfill this action plan. As you know, action plans often lie on shelves and get dusty. And we're very determined that a lot of work and investment that was spent on this would actually be fulfilled, and there will be policy, and there will be debate, and there will be legislation, and there will be support to the department in fulfilling this. The other very important area in understanding biodiversity is obligatory on us in our Act, which is to develop a monitoring framework around biodiversity, biodiversity loss, and biodiversity health, and report to the minister. And this is an area that we also working on, and I'm sure you'll see some of the work we've done already, the red list, the threatened ecosystems work, the threatened species work, all of that is work that we do in support of the department. And as I said, the work that we've done on threatened species and threatened ecosystems is really world-class scientific work. And in all of our talk about institutions and what they should do in contributing to the economy, I really am very, very adamant that we must maintain the level of science that we have. It is key for our influence on the globe. It's some of the reasons why we are so popular in our sector on the globe, and I think it's very important for South Africa. The second area is really fulfilling some of the discussion I had about the need to coordinate and harness and not double dip and not have parallel processes. And it's a model for integrated biodiversity management. We already have an array of collaborative cross-sectoral work, cross-sectoral biodiversity programs at biome level and ecosystem level. And National Park, for example, is one of our institutions that play with us in this arena. We lead it. The grasslands work, some very interesting work around with miners and with the mining industry and with the forestry industry around managing biomes better. The wetlands work I talked about, the Cape, which is a work in the Fynbos, Skip and Step. We are working on best practice models for biodiversity management, and we have worked on it for some time. And one of the very important areas that we are working on is working with what we call mainstreaming, working with municipalities, particularly helping them to insert biodiversity and conservation into their integrated development program. And for that, we have been developing tools, and I really wish we invited the Honourable Chair to come to the launch of the Biodiversity Advisor, which is a tool that we hope will reduce the cost and reduce the use of consultants by the private sector, so that the information around biodiversity is in the public arena, and you, with a click of a button, you as Joe citizen can get a huge amount of information and make decisions, and will cut your costs both as municipalities and as the private sector. So that's a very exciting arena of work. On the KRA3, which is our botanical gardens, I think many of you have visited it, I hope. We have, as I say, 9 of them. The newest one is in Hantam. It is an unusual garden because, unlike others, it's not in a peri-urban area, but our Hantam garden we see as a very important climate change work can be done in that area, and it's in it's creating already tourism income and generation there. We obviously want to be able to have this window into different ecosystems, that there be a national footprint. As you might have known, I spoke about this at another time, that our gardens are tended to be in the south, and so the real gap is in the east and in the north, and the Eastern Cape, with its unique configuration of biomes and ecosystems, is the next one, and we have got quite far in negotiating with free land from Buffalo City around that, and we are ready to use the money that the department here gave us for our garden expansion. First was in Hantam and now in the Eastern Cape. We are increasingly, the garden are increasingly like biodiversity centers not far from urban areas, and so all the work that we're doing is to make sure that it's a place of public education, a place of visiting, a place as a window of biodiversity, and particularly for urban populations and for passing tourists. Like Dr. Mabunda, we want more revenue-generated activities, but we determine not to detract from our role for the public good. But if you, I happened to stay last night in Kirstenbosch and Cliff Richard was playing and the place was packed and enormous amount of money is made through projects, through concerts like that. The challenge is to ensure that the kind of artists we bring can attract a variety of clients. And that we spread that notion to other gardens, like Pretoria Gardens, for example. On the policy advice side, our aim is to provide particularly policy to our mother body, and I think that they have said nice things about the work that we've done in support of them, and that is continuing. We particularly are working at the policy level and support of policy in the climate change arena. And as I pointed out, the science has been attacked globally, and we want to ensure that it's more evidence-based. And we particularly want to enhance the ability of the biodiversity sector to engage with other policies and legislation, and we've beefed up our ability to do that. And then I think the big role that we play is converting the science and not only our science, but the science in the managed network into policy and working in that arena. I want to talk a little bit about the managed network and the human capital development. I don't know if I've made this joke before, but I just think that a managed network is a little of a female thing. Men, I think, go off and build empires, whereas women actually talk and engage with people, and the real value of engaging with them is not the actual institution growth, but it is the intellectual and ideas and content growth. So the managed network is quite a unique system that we've developed at SAMBI. And the aim is, as I put it earlier, is not to grow a big empire, but it is to harness the knowledge and the cleverness of the very many scientists and thinkers and innovators who live and work at various different institutions. And that has been a very important role that we've played. So we have developed structures and processes in place for this partnership, and we have an array of partners. We have partners in the NGO sector, in universities, but I think the partners that I particularly want to talk about is the citizen partners that we've got. For example, I don't know if you know this, but the amazing bird work that we do, the bird understanding of bird populations in South Africa, the majority of that work is done by a citizen core of interested citizens who are excited about birds. So, the Twitters, yeah, then they call the Twitters. But for every R1 that we invest, we figure that there's R20 we get back from using citizens as barefoot scientists. The other crowd, which is a really important citizens group, is a group called CREW, a rather odd name called Custodians of Rare and Endangered Wildflowers, called CREW. I think they were going for the CREW word rather than the actual explanation. But they, again, with the Botanical Society, really engaged across the whole spectrum of society, citizens to be interested in their biodiversity and their plants and flowers around them. And then, of course, the only way to lead the human capital development strategy for the sector is to do it through a managed network. And I want to talk a little bit about that before I end. The biggest challenge to the sector, as Dr. Mabunda said, is to make parks, conservation, gardens, biodiversity, our beautiful landscape, nature, relevant to the majority of people of this country. Now, the relevance is really, do people get an income from it? Do people see the worth of it? Do people enjoy it? Do people appreciate it? And I think that is the biggest challenge. The other very big challenge is that we need, from the majority of people of this country, scientists and seekers and innovators with the perspective of the the majority of people of this country. And of course, the apartheid legacy is that science was a very rare thing for people to do. So we are very adamant that we must look at the growth of the human capital development of this sector because of sustainability reasons more than anything else, apart from a good and right thing to do. But if we don't, we're going to have no sustainability. I'm glad that some of the questions that were asked to Dr. Mabunda was around sustainability. So it's one of the biggest challenges. The other challenge is that we have an aging population of science and professionals in this sector. So we really are very adamant that we must train young biodiversity professionals. We do, this year we had 9 PhD and master students, 5 PhDs passed in December under our aegis. We have been offered nominated for an award from the Southern African Society for Cooperative Education, because that group of people that work at horticulture level is an area that we've also been training. So we've been nominated for a prize. It is an interesting journey, gathering together and putting on one page all the attempts that have been made to build human capital in this sector. It's been green spotted all over. Everybody has ideas. Everybody says, no, it's these young people post-matric. No, it's these who are doing honors. No, it's PhDs. No, it's in the education sector in the primary school. And the answer is, it's all of that. It's all of that. And what we're trying to do is harness it so that we can make interventions that is with a good use of resources for maximum return around human capital development. That's very important. The other area 5.5 around the managed network is that we want to be able to be the one-stop shop for information and knowledge. And of course, we want to, we've got an array of users. So one of our key things we've done in this last year is the Biodiversity Advisor, where our aim is to be able to talk to the man on the street or the woman on the street, may I just say, that, as well as the professor behind the desk. So that we try and service an array of clients to basically lift up the understanding and the energy and the excitement around biodiversity to more people than we have previously done. I think there's a view that this is an elitist sector, but it is not actually. Our ancestors have been engaging with the sector and looking after this natural capital actually for us all this time. So I think that we want to move away from that view. And then of course, we want to have standards and structures and directions for collections, for biodiversity collections, surveys, maps, and inventories. And I just want to talk about two little areas here. Biodiversity collections. We're talking about plant collections, animal collections, etc. I see all my colleagues' eyes glaze over when we talk about these things because it's dusty insects in trays in museums. But the fact of the matter is that the work done by taxonomists is the foundation for science in the living sector. You cannot do ecosystem work without understanding that at a species level. It's uninteresting, it's unsexy, no one wants to touch it, no one wants to give it money. But the fact of the matter is we've got collections all over the country. They are, some of them decaying and dying, and this is an area that mandate-wise, Sandy is mandated to put their arms around and bring into the fore. So this is a very interesting area, Madam Chair. And those of you who had really the honor and opportunity to go into something like the British Natural History Museum will see how they manage their legacy of science. And we really need to do that as well. So it's one of our mandates. The other thing, which is very different but also falls under this thing, is a five-year-long planning forum that Sandy has been running. And this is where we assist the department to do that cooperative governance. How do we bring provinces and municipalities up to see? Sandy is one of the arms for doing that. The planning forum has been really, and we have, at that planning forum, 150 planners from municipalities and provinces coming together to discuss the national standards and the national approach to planning. And I think Mr. Mketeni would agree that it has produced some amazing cooperative work and foundations to research the KRA Fund. KRA 6, which is really about the organization itself and the governance of the system, we want to retain professionals. And the big debate is it about money? Can we compete with other institutions that pay more? But actually, all wisdom says it's about the environment. It's about the opportunities. The money, there is a bit element of it. But it's about opportunities to give papers, to be involved with congresses, etc. And we think we're getting there, because when we have made application for the Director of Biodiversity Education and Empowerment a month or so ago, we got 89 brilliant applications. We had such difficulty in actually getting a shortlist, because there are really good people out there who want to work for us. The other area around effective systems and processes is an effective strategy for transformation, and I'll talk a little bit about that later. The other area is we want to have a financial sustainability strategy, which really looks very honestly and bluntly at the funders, overseas funders, national funders, sponsors, as well as forecasting what we think we'll get from National Treasury via DEET and other projects, and have a financing and funding strategy for some year, 5 year, 10 year, one. And of course, we would want to, and we continue to comply with Treasury guidelines and public sector governance as an organization. Next slide, please. Okay. I think I've put the chaos, so I don't necessarily need to repeat that, but I want to talk a little bit about the challenges and opportunities. And we've talked a little bit about the challenge to excite the majority of population about biodiversity, and I raised this in the first time that I briefed this committee, and I didn't want to, I wanted to show you that we have moved on that quite substantially. It's a journey, but we have moved on it. The other item that I raised at the last time that I briefed this committee and my colleagues is the issue of income generating to sweat the assets. Now, while I agree totally with Dr. Mabunda that we must be careful not to overshadow our public good, I do think that we could sweat the assets of the state under our aegis more than what we do. I have found that, I'm not saying that he doesn't, I'm sure he does, but I feel that Sambini could sweat the assets more, and that's the process that we're involved in at the minute. The exciting challenge, I think, is working with the department on developing the value case for biodiversity. And one of that value case, of course, is the green economy and green jobs. And some of the debates, and I think yesterday you would have seen, the debate has been very much on a brown-green job focus around technologies, waste, climate change type focus. And what we want to do from Sambi side, along with parks, is to look at the green jobs, the jobs that can be created through rehabilitation of ecosystems that are vital for the economy, etc., etc. So we're working with that. The other area which I've spoken in detail on is the human capital development strategy, and we saw it as a challenge. We saw it as a challenge and a problem. In this last year, we have really now developed a joint agreed strategy across the whole sector. So we have working groups and identifying key areas of work. It's been launched in November, the beginning of the human capital development strategy, so it's very exciting. The issue that I want to talk about, I said I would talk with you more in detail, was the implementation of a sustainable transformation initiative. And for this, we have very lucky to get the Technical Assistance Unit of National Treasury support. I think one of the issues about an institution like Sandy is that there's vastly different expectations of transformation. There's a wide gulf between cultures of people.
and I'm not talking about culture in a general sense, but the culture of semi-skilled workers at garden level versus the culture of globally known scientists at another level. Culture in terms of the way the gardens have geographically spread. So the Kirstenbosch has a very different culture to Walter Sisulu, for example. But I think mainly it's the different expectations of the pace and the content of transformation in this sector and in our institution. And so one of the things we are looking forward to, and it's a year and a half long process, is working with the technical assistance unit of National Treasury, who have done this before with other institutions through challenging times. That's what their subline says. And what we hope to get out of it is binding values. I'm not saying that we must all be the same, because I think it's impossible. But a binding values, a binding identity, and definitely a transformation charter that we hope to be a model for other institutions. And we are now in the first phase, the diagnostic phase, which is being all the stuff, most of the stuff being interviewed confidentially about the issue. So we're really excited about that. And I've been out and talked with many staff about their issue. People are anxious about change, but I think they're anxious because they don't know where we go to, and this is what we hope to get better on this. The other area which is part of our transformation is the discussions I've been having with the union, NIHA. That's another legacy of the past, is that the union only managed, or only dealt with, or only had members in the blue-collar sector of the organization. And yet this is a changing organization with lots of people coming in at administrative, young scientist level, junior management level, who would want to be members of the union and are not. So we're talking about reviewing our recognition agreement and clarifying roles and responsibilities. But most importantly of all, for me, I want to tap the intellectual capacity of NIHA in looking at the green job challenge. And they're very excited about that. So one of the things before I conclude, and my colleague talks about the finances, I think one of the big balancing acts that institutions like Zambia have to do is how much do we spend on internal and how much external. And unfortunately, we have to multitask because it is very important to get internal right. Otherwise, you cannot function. You can't be so great and great scientists, you just cannot function. But at the same time, there are exciting and important things happening nationally and globally that we have to engage with, or we lose our position as key thinkers in this. And of course, the key area that we really feel we can contribute mostly is this exciting area of green jobs, green, sustainable green jobs, which there have been historical precedents in the world that we can do that. And in our country, where we've got such amazing nature and such amazing biodiversity, I think we haven't focused enough on it. We want to work on that going forward. Thank you, Chair. And now I'm going to ask, if you don't mind, can I ask my colleague, Mr. Kwakli, to talk about
finance?
Thanks, honorable member. I'll try to go quickly over the finances. I know they are very important. I've got only two slides to go through. The first one being this consolidated performance, what we normally call the income statement. And January, which is what was at the end of the third quarter, so we still have the very close to the financial year. So we thought we'd just share our results with you. We have the top section, which is actually our income statement. As you can see there, the revenue streams are mainly for the government grants. We have the investment income, other grants and sponsorships. We have sales, rent received, disposal of fixed assets, and the most important, again, is the admission fees. The government grant is guaranteed at the beginning of every year. Investment income basically comes from the the interest that we will receive from the excess cash that is invested with a bank. And the other grants and sponsorships are basically donations that we raise. We have government grants from external governments, some institutions, some bequests, and mainly those are majority of that is actually external grants. And rent received, we have restaurants within our gardens, which are actually concessioned, and we have contracts with the concessionaires or the operators, and that's where we get the rental from. And admission fees, it's also one of our main revenue-generating streams, basically that is the money that people pay in as they come into the gardens. Overall, from total income, we'll see that we are still behind total income, which includes government grants, but we have 296 million versus the budget of 326. In our finance analysis that is made when we presented to the audit committee, we still have 21 million to make in the last quarter, so that we can make our budget from our own generation. And then on the expenses side, we have savings. Total expenses are currently at 263, and then we the total budget was 316. So we have a savings there. At the beginning of the middle of the financial year, we have embarked on a cost-cutting measures. We introduced very stringent austerity measures, looking at traveling and. So we have actually gone through there. So much as there are a few items where we showed an over expenditure, but overall we projected that we will actually make a dent. I must say that on our MTF side, we started the year with a deficit of about, a cash deficit of about 16 million from the previous year. And the board has gave us instructed us to address that situation over a period of 2 years. And we are glad that at this stage we have made actually a major dent. And our financial projections, the cash projections show that we may end up with the positive cash. So the other slide is really a comparison of this current financial year's budget with what the next year's budget. I think the CEO of the department has really spoken to a large extent about the allocations that we have received. As you can see there, that we still rely as an institution on the government grant, because our own income is really minimal compared to the grant that we are receiving. I think the economy has also, the economic situation has also really made things difficult for us, as we have less people visiting the gardens. And also on the other side, the grants that we've been getting have actually been increasing at a decreasing rate. So we were not immune from the economic situation. But I think right at the bottom you'll see that the project income and the project income is really for specific projects that are outside the MTF operations. So those are sort of reinvented. So as I said when I was presenting the consolidated performance, normally when we report to the board, we produce two income statements, one for MTF, which is our normal operations as an institution, and one is presented for the project. But at consolidation level, you will see that we do not make a loss, because we do have funds from the project that can be rolled over, and those are what we call committed unspent project funds. But if we were to look purely on the MTF, before we embarked on the cost-cutting measures, we were still making losses. But currently we have really made a dent. We have succeeded in containing a lot of costs, and therefore we are not expecting any deficit. But overall, the organization will end up accounting-wise, we call it a surplus, but it's not actually a surplus because we are careful that we should not suffer the same consequences as our sister organization, passport, where money will be taken back to fiscal. But those are actually committed funds. So I think, Chair, in the interest of time, I will end there. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Honorable Lasmo, Honorable Mamusi Galala, Honorable Scottson, and Honorable Orovisa. And then after the questions on this one, we'll break 5 minutes for tea, and then you can take the next to them.
Thank you, Chair. I have just a few questions. And the first one is really what sounds like a silly question, but what is the difference between a garden and a botanical garden? What makes a botanical garden? Because my garden at home has also got botanical species in them, they plant. So I'm just interested in why it's called a botanical garden. But you spoke a lot about sharing of information, etc., and I was wondering how you work with private conservancies. The focus, and it was mentioned, Chair, at the beginning of the presentation, that Sandparks has definitely, excuse me, an advantage because it's got elephants and things that get people excited. I mean, the challenge obviously is to get people excited, as was quite rightly said, about plants as well. Do you work with private conservancies? There are a number across the country and developing private conservancies. I'm also interested in disabled enjoyment across your gardens. I presume that forms very much part of your garden's sense and, using the different senses other than sight. A lot was said about green jobs, Chair, and it would be interesting to hear just a few examples, because we hear a lot about green jobs, just a few examples of exactly what are those green jobs you envisage. The government grant income, it was said, and it is clear from what was presented, is far too high. I mean, it's just not sustainable. If you're saying that the number of visitors has actually gone down, the gardens are not attractive to people. Now, I happened to be at the Cliff Richard and the Shadows concert last night in Kirstenbosch. I know my taste isn't shared by everybody in this room, but I tell you, it was fantastic, and the gardens are just amazing. Absolutely. Chair, to go to, look, every Sunday night in Kirstenbosch, there is a concert, and they have top artists, Prime, Circle, Watershed, Just Ginger, Freshly Ground. They are appearing in Kirstenbosch Gardens every Sunday night. It is absolute. Cape Town uses Kirstenbosch. It is, they love Kirstenbosch. So it's serving more. It's not, people don't just come to look at the gardens. They come to enjoy the ambiance that the gardens provide. And last night I certainly experienced that. But the fact is that the government grant is far too high a percentage of the income. And I didn't see a lot in the plan of how that is going to be tackled. How are we going to make sure that the income from as people accessing the gardens is going to be increased enough to make them sustainable in the very long term I'm talking about. Thank you, Chair.
Tanya. Dr. Mabunda has his elephants. You also have your 4-9 flock. Fortunate. Well done. At times, some of us, we did not do science, supposedly. There is a lot of science.
sense, when you talk of biodiversity botanically, you know, a layman does not know. I once attended an environmental conference whereby we had to break into groups, and then it was biodiversity. You know, bio. And people did not understand, I'm telling you, until I had to request the one that was sharing that, could you kindly explain this word? Because they seem not to understand now the whole, you know. Fine. And I'm happy that this greening jobs Lovemore has just asked about. Greening. I want to know, I want to get this right from the department, so as to say. Where does greening the nation fall, under which section, when we speak of environment? Greening the nation, because I don't hear much about it, and I love it. Lastly, oh, thank you very much that handsome, now the gardens have been, you know, you've got more, 9 instead of 8. And I understand they are generating a lot, not a lot, from revenue. Because now tourism is going places, it's generating, Jefferson, a lot of revenue for South Africa. Hence, we just have to preach the gospel that people will have to attend to domestic tourism. They must not think tourism is flying, cruising to abroad, but we've got a wonderful country. South Africa is stunning. If you look at all these 9 provinces, Jefferson, you can be shocked. I was shocked when I saw Free State. I used to think it's just one of those things. Yes, yeah, I thought, could you kindly allow me to express myself? I went to Free State. I went to Clarence. I've never seen the like of it. I used to think Cape Town was expanding with its mountains, but go to Free State, you will see things happening. The last one, Tanya, I wonder what are you prepared to offer to our visitors during 2010 as Sunday.
Thanks, Mama. By the way, I come from the Free State. Honorable Kosar?
Jefferson, thank you. It's so difficult to speak after Free State has came to it. Jefferson, we got a very wonderful presentation, but I was always having some questions that needed clarity from Sandy. Jefferson, I should think we need to see these things happening practically throughout the country, not somewhere else. Because we see this greening in the screen of a TV somewhere else, but where you stay or where you park on daily basis in the rural areas, we don't see these things. I should think it's time that we must make sure that we expand this development so that everybody can feel it. And, Jefferson, I just want to be clarified about the marketing part of it. If these things are there, where they have been developed, how does this fund be marketing this area so that people can visit, in fact, can reach this area, especially the people who stay far away from big cities and so on. And also, the issue of decent work
and economic, inclusive economic growth. I want to hear more about this because it is here in the presentation, but no elaboration made on this matter. Really, we were very much interested because this is part of our program as government of how to address these issues. And the rural development, I never yet the program, practical program, that is directed to rural areas. For instance, in KZN, next to that big river, Mezigala, where they can get water, and water in Jozinita. Yes. And the improvement of a public service. I only hear a part that talks about the relationship between the institution and the Nihau. But I really don't understand clearly what type of improvement in the public service, unless the section clarifies that. Thank you very much.
After Honorable Olamisa, I give a follow-up to Ms. Lazmus.
Chairperson, mine is just an advice. Is that this biodiversity program we are embarking upon must talk to our how to fight poverty and also deal with the threat of gentrification, which is engulfing some of the province. There was I think Tanya will recall, around 1994-95, there was a discussion paper or document. It was presented by a private individual called 2020 Concept. I think if we can go back to that document and try and review it, and assist the government, especially those who are at planning level, on how to distribute the funds. Maybe now the Department of Rural Areas will I don't know. I'm no longer in the government, so I tend to forget. Yeah, the rural development. I think it can help them if we were to use that document as a guide, because it would address these concerns which have been raised by my colleagues. We seem to be still working in silos. The documents or presentations we listen to do not talk to other programs of the state. So if I was still in the gravy train, I would have used that content to address this problem. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair. And I do apologize. I meant to ask, in connection, when I asked about private conservancies and assistance to private conservancies, I also wanted to ask about something that was mentioned during Tanya's presentation, and that's assistance to municipalities. And I'm going to use, as many times I do, my own municipality as an example, and that's in Nelson Mandela Bay, and the beautiful, what should be beautiful, Settlers Park and the Balkans Valley in Nelson Mandela Bay. If you go to the 2010 website of Nelson Mandela Bay, you will see Settlers Park described to the 2010 visitor as idyllic surroundings and the sound of water trickling, bring your picnic basket, watch the swans, etc., etc. The fact is, if you go there, you're likely to be mugged, and almost guaranteed to be mugged, and you're actually lucky if you come away with your life. There have been a number of fatal muggings there over the last few years. It is extremely dangerous, and so it is certainly not used, and it's by no means a tranquil surroundings for family picnics, which it used to be. It certainly used to be. But they don't have the staff to maintain it from a garden point of view, so it's looking tacky, and it needs work. They've been speaking for a long time about having it declared a botanical garden, but they need assistance. Now, I'm just interested, as I say, I'm using that as an example because it's something with which I've been involved. How Sandy is involved with municipalities and such instances. Thank you, Chair.
The lady has mentioned that there is national research agenda related to climate change and bioadaptation that has been developed and implemented. But my question is whether the people in rural areas have been participated in that research and how are they benefiting in it as well as in your program, because they are the ones who are being affected by the climate change. Thank you. When you come back, I want responses. Can you help or something? No, it's not here. Okay.
I was trying to keep that discipline there. Chair, I think mine is not a question as such on your KRA1. I would love if you can share that research with the members of this committee. That's the first one. Again, on your KR1, again, you're talking about the research policy there. I would love, because you're saying that this, you've actually changed the scientific into a policy, if we can be able to have some share of that. Sometime last year, I think it was last year when you came to make a presentation to this committee, I'm on your KRA3. I asked, what are you doing in assisting the municipalities? Because some of the gardens and the town halls and some of the towns are actually in Tata. And each time you drive past, I always get very worried. What has been done by your department in actually, improving those gardens for 2010? Because we are saying people must come, we are selling all these niceties to them, and yet all these gardens in the towns, right, in the cities, or in the city center, they are actually in tatters. And for me, it's a worry. I know the answer is going to say the municipalities, this and that. We are all talking about one government. And for me, the answer of saying that municipalities don't want to be assisted or this, because I remember you sort of gave some, answer that was sort of that. And for me, that is not enough and a good answer, if you are saying that you want to promote, this. My second comment, Chair, is around between, the gardens and also the parks. That as much as they are not business entities to produce profit for government, but I think they must also not underestimate and underplay the role that they can do in terms of being self-reliant and self-sufficient as entities. We had, Treasury was here, presented to this committee, to say actually this department is actually failing, because they've got lots of entities that can be a resource, and they are not tapping enough on those. So I am challenging the entities that are supposed to be self-reliant, so that as they themselves are saying that the global economic downturn is actually affected. They are then supposed to be coming to us with some creative ideas of how they are going to turn around, not to rely to say it's not our mission to make money, but it is their responsibility and their duty to make sure that they are self-reliant, so that they do not rely. I want to emphasize that, Chair, because I heard this yesterday and I'm hearing it again today, and I'm emphasizing that self-sufficiency, self-reliance is important, not profit, of course. I want to emphasize that. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable.
ngaphandle kwe-Saint Pancras kwakhona. U-Saint Pancras uthile njalo uyazibhandela yena. Mama Ndudi. Amabutho uyazibhandela yena. Okay, let us break for 5 minutes for
towards Worcester, on your left, there is the Karoo National Botanical Garden, and it reflects all the succulent plants, most fabulous succulent plants of the Karoo area, and it's based in Worcester. Just an example, yeah. At different levels of government, and I think I've said this before, so I don't want to say it again, but at different levels of government, there are, particularly at municipal level, there are gardens managed by municipal level. So, for example, Johannesburg Garden and Durban, I don't know if you know this, but Durban Garden is actually not one of ours. It's actually a municipal garden, very well run, but it doesn't only have indigenous plants in it, it has a variety of plants. One of the movements that we are involved with in with municipal gardens is to indigenize them, actually, because of a longer-term need to have refuges for climate change plants, plants who are affected by climate change, to have refuges in these gardens. And we can't only do it within the 9 National Botanical Gardens. So there's a general move amongst municipal gardens to indigenize, and we are part of that network to do that. But in practice, they are not under our role to play. But the way we are working with municipalities, assisting municipalities, is helping them with their integrated development program. So that part of that integrated development program would be a recognition of the importance of having reserve and green belt areas in the municipal areas. And in that way, we are assisting them. We're working close with the Department of Local Government with this. And we've just got a grant from the DBSA, for example, who manage some municipal funding to say, how do we insert the notion and the value of having municipal gardens from a scientific perspective and from a climate change perspective, and of course, essentially also from a leisure and pleasure perspective. I hope that answers the question. The MP made some comments about private conservancies. And I think that really that is something that, Dr. Mabunda works with more closely than we do. We have been working with municipalities in assisting them to create gardens that have a green belt, green lung, and also refuges for climate change refugees. Disabled enjoyment. First of all our gardens have access for all and have disability access. But most interestingly, we have an educational program, particularly to design gardens that cater for disabled people, but also designed for disabled gardeners. And it's one of our educational programs. And let me take this opportunity, Chair, to just say we would really like to engage with the Portfolio Committee and the COP Standing Committee in visiting some of our gardens and to look at some of the educational programs which I could not cover in this very fast presentation, and some of the other work that we do on outreach for education in spreading the understanding of biodiversity and its complexity to more people. I want to just talk about green jobs and green economy and the rural development altogether. So if I could just move quickly to the notion around Cliff Richard and the event approach. Part of the transformation of this institution is to say that gardens can be the center of entertainment and of enjoyment for urban people in a green setting. And some of the constraints to that have been very minor ones. So, for example, in Pretoria, which for me has got a huge potential for creating a space in Pretoria for people to come and listen to music and to sit in a green space. That has not happened for just a small reason that the neighbors around have felt that they don't want to have loud music there. So we've had very quiet music there. And quiet music there often doesn't attract the majority of people. So those are small reasons. Kirstenbosch, for example, we had to negotiate with the local surround to get those concerts going. One of the, and also I think part of the MPU asked a question at the very end, and I just want to talk about that too. One of the successes of the NBI and SANDI have been engaging with the Botanical Society of South Africa, which has got 35 branches all over the country and really is a citizen's botanical society. One of the problems that Botanical Society, of course, have got is that they haven't transformed. They haven't been, as though they've tried, they have not been inclusive and exciting enough for the majority of people in the country. So we've agreed, we've now got a strong MOU with the Botanical Society. They represent thousands, or tens and thousands of citizens. One of the agreements we've made with them is that they must give us money for them to be have access to our garden. So we will be receiving something like 10% of their membership income going forward as part of extracting maximum value from the asset that we've got. But at the same time, we want to assist the Botanical Society to be much more representative of South Africa. And that's an interesting journey. So it combines two questions there. On Hankam, one of the honorable MPs asked about Hankam. Hankam being our ninth garden, as I say, it's a bit of an unusual one because it's actually not near a big urban conurbation. It is the bulb capital of the world and very seasonal. But Nibosville, which is at the southern part of the Karoo there, is actually a very poor area. And we've tracked what the impact of having a garden has had on that little town. And it's already created beds and bed and breakfast and accommodation. Already scientists globally are coming to particularly look at the work at Hankam. And as I said, we would really want it to be a center for climate change. And it is quite seasonal. 2010 contribution, we are engaging, all our gardens are engaging with provincial tourism authorities and the National Tourism Authority with South African Tourism in order to ensure that our gardens are on the lists and on the tour guides of the country. But I think an area that you might be quite interested in, Chair, is that we've been requested by 2010 to name a flower, a plant of for Bafana Bafana. And our scientists are working on identifying that plant. We wish that that plant will also give them lots of luck. So we want to make sure that the plant will confer luck on the Bafana Bafana. And that's one of our engagements in 2010. I want to just lump together a whole lot of questions that were asked, which was about greening, green jobs, greening the nation, rural development, etc., etc., just to because I think there were quite a few questions around that. One of the problems, I think, and I was talking a little bit with I was going to say former Deputy Minister of Environment many, many years ago, Olamisa, about it. One of the problems is that over the many years, we seem to have a lot of parallel silo processes. And one of the things we need to get together is to have one concept around green jobs, green nation, green economy. And the Greening the Nation is but one of the projects and programs in that section. And that's what we're working together with the department to get a one-page sense of what is this green job because there's so many brands of them, and one of them is Greening the Nation. You might be glad to hear that the Greening the Nation, the Vembe Greening the Nation, won a national prize last year, and we're very pleased about that. Working for Wetlands, which is a program that we do at local level, all over the country, in improving and restoring wetlands, and there's employment of people, both short-term and long-term employment of people, also an award-winning, also in the rural areas. It's another program that also creates jobs. Working for Water, though it's not within our department, is a very important program as well that I think Dr. Mabunda mentioned. But green jobs, or green jobs, in a country that is so nature-rich, in a country that where we have not really extracted the value for our people, for this beautiful nature, is something, is a journey that we're going to, we have embarked already on with the department. But we've already got very strong evidence that it works. The challenge will be to convert existing green jobs, create new green jobs, but make it sustainable and long-term, so that we can have service providers in the wetlands area, for example, who can go from wetland to wetland and be paid by municipalities for improving wetlands health. We can get service providers that are mobile, can go to Sandpox and say, we will provide a service in extraction of invasive species and that you must pay us because it's good for long-term conservation. That's the trick with those at the minute fairly short-term jobs. Agricultural development, there are a huge amount of green jobs in agricultural development. We have forgotten about those green jobs and the green job possibility. Now that climate change has come onto the scene, all of a sudden some of those issues have come back. For example, low tillage plowing, maintaining conservation areas, maintaining biodiversity within farming areas for pollination, and for biological control purposes, all of these matters have come. And all of that has got huge green job potential, including beefing up the extension services of agriculture, which I think we have neglected, in my view. And I think gives us an opportunity to create a lot of green jobs that has value and that the user will pay, that the farmers will pay, that it will not necessarily be on the public purse. That's a challenge that we must go forward. My colleague will talk about marketing. On rural development? Are we going on too long?
Yes.
Sorry. Now, I just want to say very quickly, in all our gardens, we have a very interesting medicinal plant section, and we're engaged with a farmer-to-farmer work that DST does. And just, I think the question, the colleague will ask about, give us some examples of science into policy. We do the national communication for climate change, and that has really, all the work that's done there has already gone into our climate change policy. The work that we do on invasives and GMOs already feed into policy formulation. The work that I think everybody will recognize very quickly is the work that we've done on the red data list, which is the threatened species work, and it's already gone into planning legislation and already gone into the re-look at the environmental impact assessment system. Finally, I want to say that without scientific evidence-based work on sustainable use and resource use, if we don't have good science around that, then we are in danger of extracting from nature over and above its ability to survive. And that really must be based in science. And frankly, it can only be funded by the state. It cannot be funded by the private sector. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much.
Chair, just a question on the dependence on the government grant versus the own income. We have realized that we have assets that we can actually sweat. So we have registered a project with National Treasury with their PPP unit
that is going to assist us to do a feasibility study throughout our garden to see how best to concession the restaurant and to structure the contract such that they give us maximum commerciality. So it's an ongoing process. We've recently registered that project with them, and then they will come with us, transaction advisors, legal people, to look at how we can make this, because traditionally we have had these things, but they were not properly structured. So we believe that is one of the initiatives to actually assist us in generating more income. Thanks.
Thank you, Chair. Just very quickly, after a discussion at tea, some interesting points arose around this. And my concern, and I think the concern of all of us really, is not so much that the government grant is too much, but just how sustainable it is. We certainly understand that there are some things, and over tea, the example of the police, for example. It's there for the public good. The government has to fund it. The same with Sandy, it's there for the public good, therefore the government might have to fund it. The fact is, however, that the government doesn't necessarily see it as a priority. If you had to give any South African the chance to make a list of 10 things that they would want the government to give them, it would be housing, water, electricity, freedom from crime, whatever, botanical gardens would not be on the list. So that's the challenge. That's particularly why it concerns me that the government grant is so high, because I just am concerned within the society that we have in our country today about the sustainability of that. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Morgan. When we implement that money deal, who will decide how much they get? So if we think that this is too much, we are going to say, you are not getting this. And it is around the corner. We have the power to do that very soon. That honeymoon is over. let's take Iweda first.
Thank you very much, Chair. Good morning, honorable members and my colleagues. Chair, yesterday you indicated that there are a number of people who ask you questions about the weather, and it seems like we tend to confuse them. Chair, next time when you respond to them, one, you need to share with them that we are an experienced organization. We've been around for 150 years. We are an authoritative voice in terms of climate and weather. Then the question that you need to ask them, are they checking their weather information from ETV? Because ETV does not get the information from us. So they should be getting their information from SABC. That is reliable information from an authoritative voice. Additional to that, Chair.
Wait, I can't read it now. ETV. One of the colors is
but on really, one school, they did an assignment or an exercise with some of the kids that some they must watch and look at the weather using ETV, others using SABC, and the kids came back wearing different clothes, others without. And looking at that, those who looked at SABC, they were well prepared for the day. Chairperson, also, I think the session is also to share, you've indicated to us that we need to be sharing also information and interacting. Chairperson, on page 29, the last slide, when they ask you the question again, please request them to call 082-162. They'll get the information also specific for the area that they want, any province. If then they do not, they also want to, others they can use 083-123-0500. Or we also provide services in terms of SMSs. This is some of the services that we do have that are commercial, Chair, that will help also in generating the revenue as we come up with a turnaround strategy. I thought I mustn't miss the opportunity. Additional to that, Chair, they can also talk to the focuser.
Good morning, honorable members. I think we'll be failing if we don't provide you with the weather information. More especially after these scorchy temperatures for the past 4 days where you are experiencing a heat wave. I've just looked at our historic data. 21 weather stations over the Southwestern Cape have broken record. I've just selected a few areas where the records have been broken for 45 to 50 years. So Tigerberg broke a maximum temperature record between the 8th and 9th, which was 45 years old. Cape Point, the record was 49 years old. Kirstenbosch, the record was 50 years old. Otsoron, the record was 50 years old. But Honorable Chair, the Weather Service, we thought with this meeting this week, you know, the heat wave, if you are sweating, you might faint. So we decided to organize a cooler weather. So we said the heat wave must stop Monday. So it's getting cooler now, hence we are giving 60% chance of scattered showers later today. But here we're saying 60%, so it means a chance of getting a drop on your head where you are. So don't think 60% it means it's going to be severe. It's got nothing to do with intensity. Okay, and then Thursday, it will be just isolated showers. So it means there and there. But between now and the weekend, so your temperature is getting cooler. We are expecting 24 degrees and less. And the Saturday being the coolest at about 22 degrees. So it's getting cooler. Thank you, Chair.
How I wish this was held in Old Assembly Chamber, you know, where I would have liked to see members of parliament looking at you saying what you just said, you know. Yeah, I think it was too good, really. Unless the weather can be otherwise, then I'll find you. Okay. All right.
Thank you very much, Chair. That is just the introduction, Chair. It's actually amazing that this year South Africa will be celebrating 150 years of having been in this field. And we were going through the documents, and it was also interesting to also see the transformation that has happened over the 150 years. As I introduce my board, if you're looking at the board and look at equity, it's 50-50. I've got the chairperson of the board, it's Ms. Njobe, she's an executive at the CFSIR. The deputy chair is Reverend Mbete, who's a consultant who's working with the University of Johannesburg. Mr. Msomi, who's the businessman who works with media. Ms. Mukwena, she's an attorney, she's running an attorney firm. Professor Maki, he's a retired professor, he's working with UniZulu, University of Zululand. Dr. Mali, she's also a scientist working with SANERI, South African National Energy Research Institute. We also have somebody from the private sector, Mr. Makaya, who is in manufacturing, working for ASMEC. Manufacturing of manganese. We also have Honorable Ms. Joanne Wish, who is representing the department, and Mr. Lance Williams, who is before he moved to the Western Cape. He was with the DPLG, former DPLG, and the Disaster Management Center. Now he's in the Western Cape in the office of the Premier. And also Linda Makulin is the board member. Those are the board members. But it's... But... It was interesting when I looked at the document when Weather Service, the Weather Bureau was celebrating 100 years, that was 50 years ago. And the board members, or when the committee was established, it was all male, and in different fields. We had people who are astronomers, we had engineers, we've got curators from the museum, but now we've got 50-50. So we're moving in the right direction. Members, my presentation, going through the presentation, I thought I would be failing the members if I don't share with you the background and the interesting history. On the 26th of October, 1860, where the service was established, where a committee was formed, and during that time, there were few, not automatic weather stations, few stations that were there to observe the weather. Over the period, what has happened is that in the early 1900s, the Weather Service was working very closely with the Defense Force, the Air Force, providing information for the Air Force. And around 1949, it was transferred to the Department of Transport, providing information for aviation. So as one of the services that we provide, honorable members, we make sure that members are safe when they take off their flights and also when they land, because no pilot needs to take off without knowing what the weather conditions are. So in 1940s, Weather Service was with the Transport Department, and in around 1986, it was transferred to the department. Around 1977, members, it's a typo, that's 1969, it's a typo. The first computer for numerical weather prediction was actually installed. During that time, we were actually separated from the international world. Around 1990, when we had our democracy, 1994, we were actually, we became full members of the Meteorological Organization, which is an agency of the UN. Okay. Around 201 members, South African Weather Service was established as an agency that is responsible for implementation working under the Department of, under the with governed by South African Weather Service Act. And it's during this period, members, that a lot of work and a lot of money the government and together with the entity has put aside looking at upgrading the facility, improving the skills of our people, also looking at transformation, making sure that also all people are included in terms of the work that we do. And it's during this period that we started asking questions of saying, are we relevant in terms of the information that we provide? It's not only enough to provide accurate weather information, but it's important that that information is useful for decision making. So members, I'll go through what that in terms of the strategy moving forward. May you please move to the, looking at the purpose, statement of purpose, South African Weather Service is an authoritative voice and a legitimate provider of meteorological, climatological, and related services to the South African. And not only to the South African, also looking at the continent at large. Was one of the things that is a challenge, weather knows no boundaries. If you've got severe weather in Namibia, or you have in Mozambique or Zimbabwe, that comes to South Africa. Looking at our vision, to be the foremost provider of relevant services in respect of weather, the issue here is the relevancy of the services that we provide and to ensure sustainable development in South Africa and looking at the continent in terms of long term. Our mission, one of the key things whether we talk to the IPCC reports that are coming, or you talk to policymakers that are looking at climate change issues, the information has to come from the weather services throughout the world. And we do that by having observation networks. So it's important that we enhance the observation networks and communication networks that we have, so that the decision makers, when they get that information, it's quality information. And the other area, in terms of the strategy moving forward, is the emphasis on collaboration with their different partners. Using the cutting edge technology, the other area that I'll also talk about, which it is our responsibility, is to develop and manage talent. That's one of the areas that is very important. And we cannot do that without making sure that the fiscal discipline and also looking at resources that are limited that we have and make sure that we use them optimally. But the other area in terms of the mission, which is linked to the relevance of the work that we do, the questions that we're asking ourselves to say over the next 3 years, in fact, over the next 15 years, what is it that we need to do? We need, in terms of the science that we look at, the science in methodology, research, and relevance, we need to come up with relevant applications. So those are some of the emphases. Members, moving to the next slide, please. One of the responsibilities of the Weather Service in terms of also the Act, we are a Met authority. We need to actually monitor and look at the quality of all the airports, whether they meet the requirements in terms of the aeronautical or weather equipment that they have. We've got that responsibility as an organization. And we are, as a country, a member of the International Civil Aviation Organization. And there are requirements and standards that are set. And there has been a strategy that has been developed by OCAIO, where for Africa, it's called AFIPLAN for 20. By 2010, all the weather service institutions in Africa, they should be have a system on total quality management system in place. It's one of the requirements, standards that has been set by OCAIO. So we proactively in the previous 2 years started to put the systems in place, and the board has approved the policy statement, and we are planning to, by the end of this financial year, to have an ISO accreditation as one of the programs. Moving to the next slide. Just to look at the organization as a whole, in terms of the enterprise view, one of the things that OCAIO and also the total quality management, it puts a lot of emphasis on making sure that you meet the customer requirements. So if you look at the first pillar, one of the things that we do continuously, and in terms of our strategy, is to actually continuously analyze the needs of our clients so that we can come up in terms of the pillar to satisfy those needs. The backbone in terms of the work that we do, human capital, we cannot emphasize it. It's very important that we do have those expertise that are needed. The other area that is very important for us, to be in a position to collect the information from the atmosphere, to analyze it, to archive it, to disseminate it to different stakeholders. We need to have an advanced and a developed information and communication technology. Those are some of the things that are important, and in terms of our strategies, we look at that. And we also, in terms of one of the very important areas within the Weather Service, as I've indicated, that there are standards that are set that at any given time that we need to meet. Because for aviation, there's an issue of safety. So certain information need to be given in a certain way, You need to have a number of employees at any given time at the airport to inform the pilots. Those are the standards. And then looking at also the other regulations that are also there. And in terms of strategic leadership, members, it's one of the areas in corporate governance that we are looking at. As we're developing the strategy, we looked at the next slide, please. As we're developing the strategies, we looked at what the organization has been doing over the past few years, and also in terms of what we do have and moving forward. And we started asking ourselves questions in terms of how are we going to be contributing to the key priorities in the country.
Can I interrupt you? I'm sorry, because I'm so in love with this subject, but unfortunately I had to leave. These people who are building houses and all these funny things were being called by Auditor General. There was a task team that was established by Parliament to deal with, to monitor service delivery in all 9 provinces. So you know we are affected as Water says now. There is a report that has been given to whoever. And I must also go and sit there and listen to what they are saying about Amanda. Then I'll be back at 2 o'clock. Mr. Matebe will then continue with the meeting. I'll be back just an hour to there.
Thank you, sir. How we are going to contribute in terms of the different priorities. We want to actually look at the disaster risk reduction program, which I will talk about, and also one of the areas that we need to be marketing more is the fact that the organization has got a lot of information that can be used by the public that dates a number of years, and it needs to be packaged in a manner that people are able to use that information for decision-making and risk management. It's one of the areas that we will be paying attention. We'll be in a position to do that when we also look at the research that will come with those applications, working with other institutions. One of the priority number two, looking at also infrastructure, one of the members raised a question in terms of modernization. I will also talk about that when I get to that program. One of the also very important areas that we are putting more emphasis is human capital development. What we've also learning from countries like America, America has got a very well developed industry, weather industry, different companies that are providing tailor-made risk management products. And I think it's an area that in South Africa, in terms of developing that market, it's still at its infancy. Those are some of the areas that we think going into the future, we have to look at that. Next one. We cannot, actually, when you look at priority number three, one of we've got a few of some of the programs or looking at corporate social investment, working with different communities. I can cite two. One is in the Eastern Cape, where for one of our rajas, we work with Highbury community, where we use the land, and what they do also in return is also we provide jobs for them. They do the security, they also do the cleaning, but it's managed by the community, and they actually rotate in terms of everybody in that community gets a chance to work maybe for a month. So the alternate in terms of the funds will pay for that. But there is a bigger project where we'll be assisting them in actually upgrading their school and showing that we can take the weather, the knowledge to the people. Those are some of the things that we are looking at. One of the areas that is very important in terms of the priorities, priority number four. South African Water Service is one of, in fact, the institution that the country depends on in terms of training of meteorologists. And so we're working with a number of universities. We are putting a lot of emphasis on that. I will talk about it when I talk about the programs themselves. The other area, which is important also for the future, is that with the changes in climate, there is a need to relook at the curriculum in terms of geography and all that. We have started a program where we work with teachers. We donate the weather stations. Then those teachers are actually trained on how to interpret the information from the weather station. Then they actually link the training with agriculture and others. Additional for us as an advantage, that information is also part of our network. So, the information that is coming from those weather stations, we also use it. But we use that to also training. We also recently had another one with the UniZulu, where we have the weather station and it's being used by atmospheric science students in UniZulu University. Those are some of the things that we're looking at. Moving to priority five, one area maybe looking at the future, and I think it would be important for me to wear a different hat, is that looking at the information that's there at the Weather Service, it would be important to come up with forecasting tools that will assist the doctors, the pharmaceutical industry, all those that in the medical field that are making decisions. One, for vector-borne diseases, we're talking about malaria, we're talking about Rift Valley, and a number of other diseases. Talking about cholera, we know that. I mean, it's actually known that after a long drought, you then the rains come, you tend to have outbreaks of cholera. So we need to be looking at coming with tools like that. And I think as part of the challenge that we have in having enough funds to do work like that, it's some of the things that we need to start collaborating with the Department of Health. If you look at the Department of Agriculture and look at livestock, this country's got around 55 diseases that are affecting livestock. And 80% of those are transmitted by ticks, flies, and all those, they are dependent on weather patterns and climate, the changes that are happening. We need, as a country, as an organization, moving forward, I'm not talking about this 5 years, I'm talking 15 years, 10, 15 years, we need to have application coming up with models that will assist the Department of Agriculture when they make a decision in terms of coming up with DIPs, the amount of money that they need to spend on ectoparasites. That's how I see the organization moving forward. But having said that, for now, one of the projects that we have together with the department, we're looking at air quality. Peter is really passionate about the air quality, and indeed it's very important. If you look at the HIV and tuberculosis and the link to respiratory diseases, the quality of air is very important that we monitor that. So we've got that project, and we will be launching phase one of that project, Peter, very soon, and showcasing some of the applications that we need to be coming up with. And when Peter gives the information about how much carbon dioxide, methane, and all that, some of that information we have, they've given us a responsibility to manage it, to keep it in our data. So those are some of the programs that we also have. And without moving to fiscal discipline, one of the things, yes, is look at fiscal discipline and also looking at issues around
fraud prevention. What was really interesting, as we start engaging the stakeholders, the different stakeholders, we were actually differently approached by the Fraud Metro Rail Police. And it was interesting when they said they would like to develop an integrated warning system for themselves. And one of the things that they've noticed is that when the weather conditions are bad, there is an increase in crime in trains, and, you know, because they are wearing a bigger jacket, and there is an increase in petty crime. And then it's important for them to have those warnings so that when they do their planning, they know how many people to deploy at certain areas. So those are some of the projects that we are looking at as we move forward, which is really interesting for us as well as the weather service. Moving to priority number six, priority number eight. The other area, we've got, as an organization in South Africa, we need to actually be pursuing African, advancing African needs and ensuring international collaboration. I think with the weather service, what we have done in actually the last few years, one, we are a member of the World Meteorological Organization, and we are in the leadership of that of the organization as the executive in the executive council. We are serving in that, and we are serving in a number of technical commissions as well. And if I may say, in terms of marketing, which shouldn't be winking in the dark, is that we have been nominated. I am the chairperson of the gender mainstreaming within the WMO, and it's for the first time that there is that committee. So those are some of the things looking internationally. It's the World Meteorological Organization. The World Meteorological Organization is one of the UN agencies that has got the responsibility of looking at weather, climate, and hydrology issues, and giving advice to the UN. It's a UN agency. Then what has also happened, we also looked at our region, the SADC region. In 2007, Meteorological Association of Southern Africa was established, which is MASA, and its members, it's all the SADC countries, the Met services in the SADC countries. The reason why we established that, and South African Weather Service during that time has been the interim secretariat. And now we've got a board, and South African Weather Service, we are the chair of that board. The reason that we felt it was important for us to form that structure, it was to assist in mobilizing funds for the SADC region in terms of capacity building, in terms of infrastructure development. Because even if we can have all these models around the world, if we don't have the basic infrastructure that collects the information, it becomes a challenge. And it is a challenge in Africa that some of the countries do not have the necessary infrastructure. And it was important for us to start with South Africa. We tried to mobilize some funds, and we managed to get some funds from the Finnish government for MASA as a collective. We'll be looking at that. So members, those are some of the issues that we are looking at in terms of the programs. Looking at priority number nine, I will talk more into detail when I talk in terms of the programs, looking at climate change and variability programs that we have. Priority number 10, we thought it was important to have business integration with total quality management. That's what we're going to be achieve. And the other thing that we'll be putting emphasis in the next 3 years is to have joint specific fora, different forums where we talk about agricultural issues, at another forum where we talk about water and meteorology, because water comes from the atmosphere and it lands here. So we need to have those different fora with the different sectors as we move forward as part of the strategy. One of the things that we also do is to observe the values. We tend to have values that all of us we put on the wall, but we've used a very simple system within the weather service. In all our meetings, we appoint two people to observe whether we are living the values as we conduct ourselves. And they give us feedback. Even when we've got staff meetings, they do give us feedback. The staff give even management feedback on how we are living the values. And we find it is very simple and also interesting, and people tend to internalize the values of the organization. Moving to the strategic goals, members. The strategic goals, the organization, we chose five. One strategic goal is to ensure continued relevance of meteorological products and services in compliance with all applicable regulatory frameworks. The issue there is the relevance. And for us to be relevant, we're looking at objective number two. Management of stakeholders and partners and key clients is also very important for us. And number three, we cannot do that without having a financial muscle. So we look at short-term viability because we've got challenges with funds. And then we said, how do we then long-term look at sustainability of the organization and utilizing the resources better? The other one, which is key, is the integration and effectiveness of the organization. With the assistance of the total quality management, it's one area that we think would be in a position. Looking at goal number five, we want to create a strategy-driven human capital capacity that will make sure that the organization performs. We looked at our strategic objectives, and then we also aligned our strategic objectives with the strategic objectives of the department. But when I talk about the initiatives, I will go into detail. Well, we move to the next slide. Next one. when we're looking at the next 3 years, in fact, we said what are the strategic drivers. One, we need to comply to the mandate, which is looking at the public good and the commercial side of it. We need to align to the national programs of action, balancing the revenue, the grant, and the revenue generation imperatives, which is a challenge that we have. And our initiatives will be working around that. International obligations and also innovation to ensure broader reach and accessibility. Hence, members, I was also providing you with the SMS numbers and all that to access the, for people to be in a position to access the information. But it's an added value area of business that would like to also generate income out of that. And we need to also, as we do that, we need to adapt to technology advancement. We cannot do it without that. And looking at enhancing the regional and African position, enhancing our position as South Africa and the Weather Service in the region and also in the continent, looking at those issues. One of the areas is also looking at mitigation, skills development and leveraging on collaborations. These are the key programs that we've put in place that we will be putting emphasis on in making sure that we meet our mandate. Next. One of the things we asked ourselves, what is it that we need to do in terms of when we've got this program, what is it that we want to achieve? One, for us to be in a position to provide the decision makers with information, we also need to enhance our severe prediction capabilities. Because you can see that in terms of the changes in weather and climate, that is actually needed. So that is an area that we are focusing on in terms of research and development, coming up with focusing tools that will assist us to be in a position to give information of what's going to happen in the next 20 minutes, in the next hour, in half an hour, in 3 hours, in 3 days, seasonal, and coming then with looking at research in terms of climate, looking at what can happen in the next 10 years, in the next 20, and in the next 30 years. And we don't really, those are the areas that long term we need to be looking at. So we are starting to look at that research. And we had our dream and we had budgets that were looking at that, but unfortunately some of them we couldn't get any funding from Treasury. But we'll continue looking at a number of those programs and making sure that it also happens as we move. The other area that we want to make sure that the country is actually ready in responding to these disasters that are coming, in coming with up with applications, we said we'll look at in this year coming up with 3 applications, the following year additional one as we move, depending on the research work that we do. One of the programs that we have, thanks to the infrastructure, the money that has been given to us for the infrastructure, we have a severe weather warning system in place. We are working very closely with the Disaster Management Center to make sure that it's actually integrated. The other area that it has been a challenge for us in South Africa is flash floods. We are developing that capacity, working together with the Disaster Management Center. They've provided the funding of around 4 million rand for us to develop that. What we are also busy doing is also to train our focuses to have an understanding of hydrology. Now, for example, now they've been sent to San Diego, a number of focusers and somebody from the water affairs, and also our researchers within the organization, so that there is that link and understanding of predicting and understanding the a little bit basic of hydrology. For the second region, there was a severe weather pilot project. It was a joint project collaboration between the World Meteorological Organization, South African Weather Service, and 5 SADC countries. It started in 2006. It was supposed to be for a year, to be finished in 2007. And it was a success, and the WMO members felt that it needs to be actually expanded to all the SADC countries, that system, guidance system, where South African Weather Service working with the other forecasters in other countries, they share information as they manage the weather conditions in the SADC. That is another program that we are busy with now at the moment. Then looking at the air quality, we also have, as indicated, members. For monitoring of trace gases, we have the Global Atmospheric Watch, which also, that information is used worldwide in terms of monitoring the gases that are happening. We also have that program. Moving to the next one, members had questions in terms of how we're going to turn around strategy. The commercialization, we have 2 units that are generating income for us that's not coming from the grant. One is regulated, we call it regulated income, it's coming from aviation, because they have to pay, there are tariffs that they actually paid, which are promulgated. And then we have non-regulated commercial income, the one that I was talking about, an additional product that we also have. We also manufacture, assemble automatic weather stations. We also manufacture automatic weather stations, which we actually... selling to also the SADC region. Okay. It might be difficult to do it in 5 minutes, but I will try. It's unfortunate. I was moving to the next one, the human capital one. Okay, I'll move fast. Thank you very much. I will try and do that in 15 minutes. One of the areas that we have looked at, in fact, when members also look at our expenses, one of the drivers, it has been employee cost. But with employee cost, it's more of human capital development. There is a lot of money that has been spent on that. And we've got a strategy that we are looking at talent management, where we've got dual career pathing. Some of the people within the organization do not really want to move into management for them to get a better salary. They want to stay researchers. But you find that because you don't have an opportunity for them to really get more, you know, in terms of the income, and but they've got experience in terms of research and what they are coming up with, it's good product. So we've got that dual career pathing. Researchers, if you want to stay in research, you can be a senior researcher doing the research, and if you want to move to management, we can do that. Knowledge management. What we've done in the last 2 years moving forward, we had a skills, a critical skills allowance that we have identified a number of experts or all experienced scientists within the organization where they've got a number of understudies. And that's what needs to be done over the next 2 years. It's part of the program. The succession plan, which is continuous, and the other area is the reward and remuneration, linking those also together. But the next one, what we also thought is important is that people, as the key institution that has got metrologists, different sectors are looking for this expertise. And people do leave the organization. So in building that capacity or that pool, we've got a bursary scheme. And last year, we had 40 of those bursary members that is also in the presentation. And most of the people, when they qualify, they are employed within the organization. So that is another way that we are looking at. We also have an internship program where we also expose people in other areas other than science. Last year, we have employed 50% of those that were doing the internship program. The other area, members, is also we looked at performance management. Members, there was a question that was raised. I'm moving a little bit fast. There was a question that was raised in terms of modernization. Water services got an infrastructure. Let's move to that modernization. Next one. Water services got an observation infrastructure throughout the country. I think part two of my presentation, members, will look at how the observation networks are spread around the country. We've got a number of automatic water stations. In the past, we used to have electronic manual weather stations. And I think scientists, in terms of the modernizing that, coming up with automatic weather stations. So we are deploying those automatic stations. At the moment, we've got that number. We've got climate stations, rainfall stations as well. And I think DG also mentioned the 240, thank you very much, DG. I know getting it from Treasury to upgrade our radar system. We have started to commission those radars. And I think in the picture, I'm actually proud to have, out of those radars that we are having, we've got two of them that are mobile radars. The reason for that is that for the future, as the weather pattern changes, we are in a position to put this and take it from Gauteng province to another province where it's actually needed. So that is one of the advantages, instead of having a radar that is in situ. Members, I will not go through the total quality management, but we've got the deadline of meeting that before the end of this coming year. And these are the collaborations that we have. Moving to the financials, members, in the next 3 years, looking at the activities that we are putting in place, we envisage that from the allocation letter that we've got, we've looked at the 135 million, from commercial income, 15 million. And when we look, convey it with our focus where we'll be ending this year, that will also have a little bit of an increase from the previous. We think that will end at around 10 million rands in terms of our commercial. And in the coming year, we're looking at 15 million. For aviation, it's one of those that this year we have gone back to an activity-based costing. Look at all the activities that we provide for aviation. And this year, with the promulgation of the tariffs, we're projecting that. And going to the expenses, in fact, over the next 3 years, we are projecting that we need to break even. Next slide. Members raised the question of saying there is an issue of balance between public goods and commercial. What we also did with our ABC costing, looking at all the activities, we have break down all the activities that at the end of the day are actually public goods and are getting the grant. And we've also looked at cost recovery is aviation, and then looking at special commercial services. Special commercial services, the activities at the moment are actually less than 5% of what we do as an organization. Next one. Looking at the turnaround, what we also did was to look at the history from 2006 to say, is it possible, are we going to be in a position to try and turn around and see that we get other funds? The non-regulated commercial, it's showing a trend that is actually growing, and also the regulated commercial, which is aviation. We are still awaiting the promulgation for this year. These are actually the trends, Chairperson, comparing the last 2006 to 2012, how the organization we have been doing. We had a deficit in 2008, stroke 9. 2009-10, we envisage by the end of the year, because this is still a focus, that we will be in a position at this year to break even. We're trying to manage our resources in that manner. What we also looked at, there are three drivers in terms of our expenses, is employee cost, operating cost, and admin cost. The next slide, please. And if you look at that, those are the three areas that we look at all the time. We have tried to make sure that you ask questions around administration to ensure that we've got control over that. The area that is still showing an increase is an area of employee cost, but it's because of the development strategies that we are putting in place, which are necessary for the organization. These are some of the cross-cutting initiatives that we've put in place. The next slide. And also our CAPEX budget over the next, up to 2011. Thank you, sir.
So because we are running late, I will only allow one question or clarification from members, one per member, and then we will then provide answers when you come back after that. Mr. Morgan, Mazis, Kosana, Madure. I'm going to move on.
Okay, thank you. Okay, might take 30 seconds. Thank you, Chairperson. Commercialization is an important part of SOAR's business, and I know, CEO, that you were appointed on that basis to drive commercialization. I have serious concerns about the degree to which it is not happening, and I doubt whether commercialization targets have ever been met since 2001 by SOAR.
And I have serious concerns about whether your profits that you're generating are in fact genuine profits. And the reason I say it is that, I mean, with regards, for instance, to the recent commercialization project in Australia, I'm told by staff in your department that the expenses of that were not paid for by the income from the project, but were in fact paid out of the operational maintenance budget of SOARS, which is a government grant, which inflates the commercial profits of this. So I'd like you to comment on that and defend your commercial operational project, because in my view, these are not real figures which you're giving us.
Question limited, Chairperson.
We are discussing weather. I just want to be practical this time. Can you explain to the committee why are the privately owned planes crash most of the time? Because you are looking after the airport, you monitor all the airports. And Jefferson, I need to be like moon. What happens when they thunder and lightning? And why is the man walking in the field or on the path wherever is being struck by that? Because I want to explain to the people representing. Thank you. Yeah, no. Okay. I would definitely not. I won't follow Mazri at all. But I think I'm glad that Mr. Ndaba is here. At least has been able to give us the weather until the weekend. At least we know how to pack some of us who are traveling. You know. Having said that, thank you, Chair. I just want to. I've got just two comments. One of those for me is on the training center. It will be very interesting to know how much the intake of the trainees and the demographics of those intakes that they are taking. That's the first comment. The second one is on the corporate social investment. I think it is, for me, again, in that I would love to understand the areas, that the programs that are benefiting from their social investment. And on the retention of skills, I must say that I do concur. You see the old and new faces, and I must say, really, I do see a lot of new faces, but also the old faces are there. So in that one of retention and also the new skills, one can be able to say that, well done on that one. One can always, attend to that. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Last year, this institution presented a financial report with unqualified statement, and there was a fraud made by one of the officials within this institution of 1.1 million. And as a committee, we requested a cost recovery plan. Can I just get the latest development on that cost recovery plan? Because we need that one.
Okay, a question from Daryl Woods, who had to leave to go to an NCOP plenary. On page 15 of the handout that we were given, it shows the aviation, inter alia, the aviation income on the budget 2010 to 2013, and it is shown as first rising in 2011-12 and then declining in 2012-13, and his question that from Daryl Worth is simply why. And then my question, I know, is a difficult one perhaps for you to answer, but it just, people's lives are at stake. You are the first, through you, Chair, you are the first in a chain of information, and this is with respect particularly to flooding. you provide information that, going back to your 150 years of climate information, and I'm going to use, a personal experience that I had with, in fact, one of your staff members who was extremely frustrated and brought me pictures going back many, many years of floods that had taken place in the Nelson Mandela Bay Metro. And the floods were just increasing in intensity. He was warning the local authority, which every disaster management person should actually be doing, that the more they pave, the more runoff there is and the more the flooding is actually going to be taking place, because you don't have the natural sponge of ground, you've now got paving. And he was receiving absolutely no response from the local disaster management people, from the planning people whatsoever. The fact is, he had knowledge that that ultimately could result in death, and in fact, in the last flood in Port Elizabeth, did result in death. Not because of his fault, the fault of the municipalities where they had not taken the requisite action. So I come back again to the issue that I raised the last time round, and that is disaster management, which I believe to be the weak link in the chain. Actually, I'm a very long story, but how, I'm talking now interdepartmental, intergovernmental, cooperative governance. You are the first link. How do you make sure that there are no weak links in the chain that ultimately will save the lives that you are hoping? Well, save the lives. Leave it at that.
The last one. You did allude to the fact that you are providing buffers and itinerary to students. Now, which is good, of course, but how do you disseminate this information to ordinary people at remote rural areas? Thank you.
On that note, we are there for lunch. We'll come back and